Hello, Ron. I'm here with Maikaru, who is a veteran of the atheist community, and he's going to be telling us about his experiences with feminism and social justice in that community and the damage that it did. Hi, Maikaru. How's it going?
It's all right. I am a veteran of the social justice warrior invasion of the atheist and skeptical community, but I'm not bedridden with PTSD, I'm happy to say.
I can't believe it. I thought everyone in that movement was.
Anyone who's anyone.
Yeah, exactly, the famous ones. So would you like to tell everyone just about yourself and how you came into the atheist scene and what happened?
Oh, well, I mean, taking it back, I was nominally raised a Roman Catholic, just so that my grandmother on my father's side didn't have a stroke. But my mother is British, and so she was C of E, which is, I guess, as close as agnostic as you can come. So I was never really a believer in any of this. You know, in the Catholic Church, you can, when you're a certain age of, you know, being able to reason, you're supposed to become a full-on member of the Catholic Church. But of course, if you're able to reason, then you just reject that. So I made communion, but it was never confirmed, and I've been an atheist since as long as I could remember, and had an interest in skeptical topics, you know, using it, things like Eric von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods, or Ronald Cush's The Bermuda Triangle Mystery Solved, just as a way to use these as examples of how people's thinking can go wrong. So I was amazed. I sort of was out of the atheist and skeptical community, at least online, for a while, and then I came back in during, really, Elevatorgate, where...
Ah, yes, Rebecca Watson, is that?
Right. She was a long-time participant on the JREF boards, which themselves made a transition into social justice, La La Land, and general pandering and white knighting somewhere in this process. And, you know, I was not there when apparently a bunch of people who, for whatever reason, thought it would be cool to dye their hair purple and become an atheist. I came in a little bit after that and then wondered what happened to the community. And I was absolutely amazed the extent to which they were able to weed their way into the skeptical community, showing very little skepticism, because very often fear outweighs skepticism.
Okay, I think that's a good point for us to start with, actually. Fear. Would you like to elaborate on what you meant when you said that?
Well, these people, and this goes for social justice warriors and feminists, are very good at shaming tactics and shutting down conversations, and they tend to vilify people, and if they can call you a misogynist or say that you're transphobic or whatever phobic for criticizing them, usually it takes the form of you criticize someone for something that they said on logical grounds, and then they try to turn it around to you criticize me simply because I'm a woman or I'm something or other. No one wants to be painted with that brush. No one wants to be made to look intolerant. And in fact, if you look at some of the things that they've done, like the BlockBot, which is something that comes out of Atheism Plus, and you look at the reasons why people were added to the BlockBot, I got labeled misogynistic, transphobic, this, that, and the other thing. And, well, I was transphobic because I made a reference to the porn genre Chicks with Dicks, which is something that they use for transphobe, and that got me labeled a transphobe. I also got labeled anti-Semitic, simply because I did a few tweets questioning why it is that the first wave of attacks that they made against men for various sexual indiscretions were Lawrence Krauss and Michael Shermer, that is, two notably Jewish skeptics. And for bringing that up, paradoxically, they labeled me an anti-Semite. You see how that works?
I do.
And this is the worst thing at all. I got labeled for doubting Melody Hensley's PTSD. Who wants to be hard with that brush? But really, it somehow goes on your record that now you're a misogynist has completely lost its sting. Transphobe, I don't even know what that's supposed to mean. But really, an anti-Semite? See, that hurts.
Yeah, I think...
That's the one that actually still bothers me.
Well, they're just blatantly calling you a racist there.
Yes.
And if you're going to be a racist towards Jewish people, what's stopping you from being a racist towards anyone else?
Right.
So it's no wonder that I would agree that's quite shocking, really.
See, their major weapon isn't logic or critical reasoning or attacking a person's argument. They attack the person. It is inherently ad hominem, and what the weapon that they use is disapproval. I disapprove of what you said. Now, for some people, that will actually, everyone likes to be liked. And in fact, the online radical feminists, that is their main weapon. If you criticize them, they'll say things like, oh, you're a little man, a real man wouldn't say that.
Shaming language, yes.
Shaming language is inherently, my power is disapproval.
Yes, I don't generally like to sort of gender these sort of things, but it is inherently female, and it's always inherently used towards men. One of the things that I think most men just can't stand is to be shamed by women. I know that's such a generalization, but I really do think it's true. You know,
anti-woman or thing, the deck is stacked against women. It's such nonsense. I mean, males are almost hardwired to appease women. I mean, not all of them, but the structures are set up that, you know, your success as a man, even your on the most basic level, your reproductive success is based upon appealing to women. Many men take careers because this is the kind of thing that women like.
Absolutely. I think that honestly, I think that almost everything about sort of traditional masculinity is just designed to attract women, really. It's designed to promote and protect and just, I mean, it's what women go for, generally. From what I've seen, from my experiences in the world of, you know, interpersonal relationships, this is what I can't understand about these sort of... the feminist male, who is just the antithesis of everything that women seem to find attractive in men. And they seem to use it as a weapon against other men as if, I don't know, as if somehow they can level the playing field. So they can remove all the positive attributes that women find attractive in other men so that they, by comparison, become, I don't know, maybe it gives them a way of competing.
Right. I mean, that's in very broad terms we're speaking. Obviously, with individual women that would find the reclusive poet, Cheeto-eating gamer, attractive.
I don't think they're gamers that we're talking about.
Yeah.
I think we're talking about hipsters.
No, actually, you know, the funny thing is that I've noticed that women making incursions into the gaming community invariably treat the men like Peter Pants, that they've, because they're involved in gaming, that they've never grown up. I mean, that's the stereotype that they pull. But in broad terms, I don't necessarily buy into when I read people talking about alpha males and beta males and women just want alpha. I mean, there's a lot of variation, but in the broadest terms, yeah, there's certain types that generally appeal to women. I mean, even things that are outside of your control. I mean, I've seen women on dating profiles who actually, it seems to become a meme moment almost in itself, saying, I don't date any guy whose height begins with a 5.
Yes.
Whereas only 14% of males are above 6 feet tall. So they're appealing to a very, very small segment of the male population there.
They are, and the thing is, I really doubt that they're particularly stringent on their own rules when it comes to someone that they actually do like the look of. But that's the thing, we are talking in very broad terms, but I just, the whole thing is very peculiar to me. The whole just, I mean, what do you make of identity politics?
That's tough. I mean, I find it a strange thing that that people can behave in any manner, any variety of ways, and some of the people behave in ways that are just sort of socially awkward or abrasive, and then the out is, you don't like me because I'm X. Brianna Wu is really good at pulling this number.
One of the things I've noticed about that sort of thing is it speaks to your motivations, as if they know what your motivations are better than
right.
What you know your motivations are. And so you can't ever disprove it. you can never really disprove any of these accusations.
But they want you to try to disprove it because it's another way to end a conversation. Now you're on the defensive and saying, oh, no, I'm not whatever you just accused me of. In fact, let me go out of my way to appease you, to prove to you that I'm not whatever you just accused me of, and that way you're on the hook, and then the goalpost can keep being shifted.
Yes,
it's an endless cycle of appeasement.
Yes,
and then at the end of it, they won't respect you because you're just a jellyfish.
Exactly. You haven't stood your own ground. You haven't stood by your own principles. You know, they say, well, you're doing this because you're a racist or you're sexist. Instead of just saying, no, that's not it, and I'm carrying on with how I'm doing, you've instead completely folded to their accusation. And like you say, you're dancing to their tune. They're going to keep changing the goalposts. And ultimately, you can never really prove that you're not any of these things that they're suggesting that you are. And so eventually, you end up in the sort of situation where the only option is to completely fold and completely just become entirely spineless and give in to whatever it is they're demanding of you.
And after a while, they cannot continue to pull that. The example that I think of is the Comedy Central show South Park. Early on in South Park's early seasons, they got a lot of complaints saying, oh, you can't do that, you can't say that, that's horrible, that's outrageous. And Comedy Central wouldn't back down, and they would say, well, it's a cartoon show, get over it. And now we're at the point where they can do things and no one complains anymore because they know it's not going to work.
Absolutely. I think that's the amount of Jew jokes at South Park is incredible. And I can't believe that they can get away with it. And I think you're exactly right. The fact that they've never actually bowed to any of the pressure on them, and therefore now they just don't have any pressure. I think ultimately with the social justice warriors, that's the only way to go. I mean, just today I saw an article on Kotaku, of all places. I honestly don't go there, guys. Where Blizzard had come out and made I think she's some transsexual or just extremely muscular female character for one of their games, with shocking pink hair, with, you know, big heavy weapon. And the person who was writing for Kotaku was a woman called Patricia Hernandez, who's extremely feminist and progressive. And she was thrilled by it, absolutely thrilled by it. And you would think, oh, God, look at them, they're thrilled. You know, it's a non-traditional, non-stereotypical female representation, very empowered, very, very powerful in the game. And the comments section was bitter, just the most bitter thing I've ever seen. Well, we're still not happy. We're furious about this or that or the other. And it's just like, what was the point in even trying to appease them? You know.
Well, first of all, I don't consider what I kind of think of as fashionista feminists, you know, hipster feminists, ones where that they seem to be wearing a uniform of hipster glasses and consignment shop clothes. Hair the color of neon signs. I don't consider them particularly progressive. What I see them as is selectively choosing traditional roles, especially when it comes to men. But when push comes to shove, they will fall back on saying, well, I'm just a girl.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But it's not that there was anything necessarily wrong with the character or anything like that. In fact, the character looks quite good and stuff like that. But it was just the attitude Exactly. It was the attitude that really got me. It was like, you know, Blizzard had literally turned around and said, look, you've said this, we listened, and we've decided we completely agree with you. Here's our best effort. What do you think? And it not even any charity, you know? If someone was trying to desperately... I don't want to say pander, because I don't think that's necessarily what Blizzard were doing. I think they were just trying to get it right, because there are so many rules, and these rules are almost entirely arbitrary and can be changed at any time for any reason. And Blizzard were just kind of walking through this minefield, thinking, okay, well, we just want to make people happy, and we just want to make a product that they're going to like. And the venom in the comments, they were just there was no way Blizzard was ever going to come out of this without stepping on a mine. So, like South Park, why even bother trying? You know, and again, there's nothing wrong with the character or anything like that. It was just, it really bothered me. It really got to me. It's complete lack of charity from the social justice warriors. Just, you know, again, presuming the intentions of people Blizzard, if it's not mean, it's they're incompetent. And it's just
right. But notice the selectivity. Isn't it the canard of these people that criticize games that they'll say, oh, look at this female character. She's an unrealistic body type. But they don't look at the male gaming characters. I mean, the whole thing is it's inherently hyperbolic. It's supposed to be.
They've got rationalization for that. For that, they say that the male characters are power fantasies. So men like to pretend that they are those characters, whereas women apparently don't like to pretend that they are the attractive female characters, who are the counterparts to the males. It instead makes them feel insecure and frumpy and whatnot. So, I mean, I'm willing to believe that men and women approach these things in different ways, but frankly, I come from the perspective of, well, you know, it's art and free expression. If you don't like it, that's your problem. You know, don't buy it.
Or make your own game. Because you realize what's happening again and again is that you have games that are developed by other people, or it may even be developed by women game developers, but yet these people who don't do anything, don't know anything, don't have much in the way of skills, can't get off the couch, think that they can come in and say, change this to the way that we like it, rather, you know, it's the old thing, if you don't like a movie or a book, you don't ban it, you write your own.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree. It's, I think that fundamentally they've got a lack of skills because they've spent their formative years doing gender studies degrees rather than, you know, learning practical skills that might have earned them a career.
And it's ego.
Absolutely.
They inherently think that they should be in a managerial position. You know, where they're just guiding the workers, you worker being anyone who actually does anything, and they're in a managerial position where they will tell you what to do.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? They've got a remarkable sense of entitlement. Everything about them stems from this entitlement. For starters, I'm entitled for you to listen to my opinion and give it the due weight that I give it, which, I mean, if you listen to what their opinions are, there's no particular reason anyone should listen to them. And then the entitlement of, I should be the community manager or gatekeeper. For example, I'm going to use a lot of gaming references, but that's because what I'm used to. But there was a Kickstarter for a project called Mighty No. 9, and the community manager, for some reason, they hired a social justice warrior, who then proceeded to become a tyrant on their own forums, at points banning even the backers of the Kickstarter from the forums. And just it just speaks to the entitlement. How do you think that you should be the person doing that? And what world do you think banning the people who have backed the Kickstarter from the forums discussing the game for the project is even remotely acceptable? And it was based on political opinion. It wasn't based on something that they'd done wrong, obviously. It was just based on a difference of opinion.
Right. When you peel away the thin veneer of altruism or justice or whatever they pretend to do, what they're interested in is the raw exercise of power.
Yes.
Unearned very exercise. The exercise of unearned power.
Well, it's very interesting because it is absolutely about power, and a lot of the times they will not, they aren't shy about saying it. I mean, there's another gaming reference, but there's a YouTube channel called Extra Credits, and they were asked about Gamergate. Now, there shouldn't really have been any particular. You're familiar with Gamergate, aren't you?
Oh yes.
Just checking. So, and I'm sure anyone listening is as well. But there should have been no particular reason on the face of it that they would have had any issue with Gamergate. I mean, they seem to like to present themselves as ethical people. And they seemed to, you know, I don't think there's any particular ethical violations on their part that people in the community would be concerned about. So I don't see any particular reason why they would take the stance they did, but instead I guess it's being part of a certain community that's made them in this way. But the main writer is this guy called James Portnow, and his repeated opinion in this video about Gamergate was just, it's a group of people losing their power. It's just them losing their power. And I'm sitting there thinking, look man, I'm just spending my money on video games. I want to be informed about the video games you are promoting to me. I want you to tell me if this is your best buddy's video game that you're promoting, such as Patrician Hernandez promoting Anaanthropy on Kotaku. I want to know if I'm being informed about, you know, if it's cronyism or if it's not. And apparently that's me worrying about me losing my power. And so there's a dramatic disconnect in what they think is going on as to what I think is going on.
But it's interesting. Does that make sense? It's revealing of their mindset in the same way, you know, the old saying is, the more he talked about his honor, the faster we counted our spoons, you know, because he's probably...
I heard that, actually.
He's probably heisting the silverware. No, but, you know, the people who are most security conscious would be thieves, because thieves would assume that since they're out to take everyone's stuff, someone's out to take their stuff. So when these people keep talking about things entirely in terms of power relations, it shows you what their focus is, what's interesting to them that they're projecting on other people, and their interest in the exercise of power.
Now that is another, I'm so glad we've managed to get this conversation sorted. That's another thing I want to talk to you about, actually, is projection. One of the things that I just, every time I hear a social justice warrior speak, I just ask myself, is what they have said true about themselves? And almost every time it is, until they say someone has done a great deal of work, and then I realize, well, that's not true about them. But almost every time when they say something, it's, I mean, the racism issue, and I'm talking broader than feminism. I guess what they would call it is intersectional feminism, which is effectively, I don't want to say Marxist, but it kind of is. I think I've recently been given an education in what the social justice warriors are not cultural Marxists, but they think they are Marxists. But it's quite complicated, and I think I barely understand it. But the principle is class conflict, and they think that white men are the dominant class, because if you look at the numbers in a white society, a predominantly white society, well, it's predominantly white men who are doing everything. And so they look at that as if that makes predominantly white men like the aristocrats of society or something. And therefore, everyone else, i.e. women and minorities, are the serfs who have to till the fields to the white men who are presumably in their manors eating roast pig. And so that's basically how they seem to view everything. And so they've got this little formula that they'll always trot out that say, oh, racism isn't, you know, what you're talking about is prejudice. Racism is prejudice plus power. And I just have to, you know, no, it's not. Racism is not prejudice plus power. Racism is just the opinion that certain people, or races, I suppose, are inferior or superior based on the natural biological race. It's nothing to do with power.
They have that formulation plus power because they assume that for some reason that all white males have power, which, I mean, is demonstrably untrue. One part of that is, and this is particularly true of feminists, is that they tend to always be looking up. Males that are below a certain level of status or power are practically invisible to them. In fact, it was interesting that during a lot of the sexual, in the atheist and skeptical community, there was a lot of moral panic over sexual assaults at conferences, even though none actually happened that anyone can demonstrate. but at the same time, one of my favorite little tales is at a conference, this woman was so concerned about this guy. You know, those little collapsible sticks you could put a camera on so you could do selfies of yourself with other people? She saw this guy who apparently was a little developmentally disabled anyway. Mm-hmm. With this camera on a stick, he was going around taking pictures of himself with his favorite members of the skeptical community. But in her tiny little mind, she thought the only reason he could have a camera on a stick like that is to take upskirt photos of women. Now, didn't complain at the time, maybe a week later, complained to the organizers. It seemed to be one of those things she complained after the fact so she could claim she complained and they didn't do anything. But the upshot of it, this guy was who they finally started tossing his name around, he was so distraught over this characterization of him that he didn't go to any more conferences. And you know,
because that's completely understandable. If that were you, you'd be like, well, Jesus, why are they all assuming this about me? You know, what have I done wrong? It's the presumption of your motives
and the projection.
And the projection. But that's the thing, again, it was about power.
Right.
The inherent assumption.
But the upshot of it is that when they were running around, And then they started trying to formulate rules for conference behaviors, where basically anything that you did, especially if you were male, was going to get you in a lot of trouble. Now they've set it up so that you are walking in the door, you have to walk on eggshells. And the thing that I don't like about these conferences is that they always existed in a kind of sexualized atmosphere where there was lots of alcohol present. There's a rather famous photo, a video of a party Rebecca Watson was holding where they had a male stripper in a kind of a Tarzan outfit going around and women doing test tube shots, the test tube held in a suggested manner. So it looked like they were doing fellatio on him, and it was odd. And these were exactly the same people that were saying, you know, guys have to control themselves. It was setting things up again. Hi, we're here. We have a double standard. We're in control now. We'll tell you what to do.
It's like
establishing martial law, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Honestly, I think it is about setting up a privileged class. Mm-hmm. And again, just everything, you know, and then like racism is privilege plus power. And it's like, you know, so I can say whatever I like to you, a white man, because my God, white men are the dominant class with all the power. And so, you know, like with this poor mentally challenged chap who had the power there. Exactly. He's the one forced that. And it's like, well, it's a good thing that, you know, in your mind, good thing that your definition of racism is prejudice plus power, because otherwise you would be an awful human being for what you're doing. You know, you would be an absolutely horrible person for doing what you're doing. But because in your mind you can convince yourself somehow that it's actually, oh, well, I don't have power in whatever specious rationalization that you want to use to make it so that you can believe that, then you can do horrible, horrible things to other, to really nice people who don't deserve it and who have got no particular way of fighting back.
That's one thing that I like to come around to, which is that, you know, a lot of people think that social justice warriors are just misguided or they mean well. No, they don't. They are horrible, horrible people.
Yes, yes. And it's a weapon. That's the thing. It's a weapon for them.
They are suspicious, denigrating people who slander people in the raw exercise of power, who think nothing of going into a community and instead of engaging in discussion, well, what you were talking about before, someone comes in as a social justice warrior and starts shutting people down in a way that would make a Stalinist proud.
Oh, I've spoken to a few people from Eastern Europe who lived under the communist regime, and they are in awe of the social justice warriors. And the thing is, all of this comes from universities. That's the thing. It's all coming from universities. And it's been fermenting for about 20 years. And they have been honing and refining their techniques. So it is no wonder that when they go out into the real world, they are razor sharp. And you know, they're coming across people who have absolutely no idea what's going on. They're coming across people who think that you should innately presume the good in people, that, you know, the presumption of innocence, the all that sort of thing, traditional moral values. And they have been practicing their critical theory postmodernist bullshit, and they can take them down brutally. Absolutely brutally, with very little resistance, because these people simply don't know what is being talked about. And that's why you've got all this terminology like cisgendered, heteronormative, all that sort of stuff, completely outside of most people's depth. And so this is how they can bamboozle and bully their way into a community. Right. With people, like you said, with fear. Just people, oh God, I don't want them labeling me so everyone now thinks I'm a racist. You know, it's absolutely, sorry, I've been going off with that.
No, I was about to say, you know, when I used when I said they were like Stalinists, I don't mean to overly politicize it in a left-right way, because this would be equally applicable to fascists. The distinction is, what's important is not that they're necessarily left or right, it's that they're authoritarian, and there's authoritarian right and authoritarian left. And the social justice warriors are not progressive because they are ultimately authoritarians.
I think that everyone in Gamergate has learned this the hard way. Most of the people in Gamergate are sort of central to left-leaning. There's a minority of people in Gamergate who are right-leaning. And I've never met anyone who's on the extreme right or the extreme left in Gamergate. The political left-right spectrum, I think everyone is well aware, is it's irrelevant, really, because it is entirely libertarian versus authoritarian. And the social justice warriors, like you say, are on the authoritarian spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't see gaming being inherently going along political lines. And I think that was very helpful, because there is really no left-right divide, or you could say to an extent that gaming is apolitical, which it is. I don't see much interest in politics among people that are into gaming. It was very effective in being able to shut down a lot of the incursion of social justice warriors in a way that the atheist and skeptical community was unable to do.
Yes, and what I think I think that one of the main differences is that gamers spend a lot of money on what they do, and the thing about gaming is it's very I'm just looking for the way to phrase it, really. It's very tangible. You know, you it's something that you do. You know, it's not necessarily something you believe, and it's not necessarily an attitude. It's, you know, it's an activity, so it's very easy for people to feel very close to and defensive of what they do, because what you do is what you are. You know, if you go around telling lies, then you're a liar. If you go around playing games, then you're, you know, someone who plays games. And so I think that that in itself has made it basically one of the, it's one of the reasons why there's been such a pushback. It's because gamers are very intrinsically linked to what they're doing, whereas I think with an atheist community, it's less about what you're doing, isn't it, per se?
Yeah. I don't mean to be too broad, but yeah, the failure in the skeptical community is, of course, that the people in the skeptical community allowed fear and slander to keep them from being skeptics. I mean, they basically gave these people who were acting in a completely irrational manner a free pass. And as far as the atheist community goes, atheism doesn't mean a lot of anything, which is atheism just being lack of belief in deities. Mm-hmm. There's no politics, there's no ideology that goes along with it, which is why something like Atheism Plus something or other was such a ridiculous concept. Why, yeah. Why do you attach yourself? What is the benefit to say we want to do social justice? We want to be for women. We want to be against homophobia and other things. Well, what is the added benefit of saying and we're atheists?
Well,
where does
then,
that even come from?
That's it. This is where it comes into the principle of, oh, they think they are good managers, and it's entirely self-interest. You know, everyone who is interested in social justice has something to gain from social justice.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, if I saw a court case that was just flagrantly unjust, it was just self-evident from the evidence, from say the video footage or something of the case, and there was, you know, the guy was, or the, whoever it was wrongly convicted, and that was it. No one was really bothered. I would be making videos. I would be on Twitter complaining about this, saying, look, this was a miscarriage of justice. It's you know, cut and dried. I would have very little to gain from that, other than, I suppose, the knowledge that I live in a justice system that can dispense justice and will, in future, perhaps do it to me. So, you know, but that's kind of a nebulous sort of, you know, very vague. There's no direct benefit to myself, but I would still do it because it would be the principle that I would care about. But these people don't care about principles. I don't even think they know what principles are.
No,
I think everything about it is self-interest and benefit to themselves directly.
This is kind of giving away something that I'm working on now. But
you don't have to.
for the past month or so, I had a bad case of sinusitis, and so I had a lot of time to lay on the couch and watch procedural shows on TV, like, you know, Forensic Files. And I noticed that the state of Texas in false convictions appears again and again and again. And there was one case, Loveless and Miller, these couple, they had children from previous relationships, but they were living together on a 5-acre ranch, and they had a 4-year-old daughter who they found under a tree, scratched and with this huge gouge in her leg that severed her femoral artery, and they took her to the hospital. The girl said the dogs did it. Well, they took her to the hospital, and she died on the operating table, unfortunately. And the parents were convicted of her murder. Because it was the state of Texas, they had some theory about a cult bloodletting ceremony. And
right.
They presented to the jury that it couldn't have been done by dogs because the wound on the leg, the edges were too clean to have been an animal bite. 5 years after their conviction, someone going back through the case found photos of the wounds before the surgeons got to it. And it was a dog bite. The clean edges of the wound was a result of surgeons trying to save her life by cleaning the edges of the wound. So the prosecutors and the police must have known this. And you can't say it was prosecutorial error. You can't say it was a mistake. Their calculus is simple. which is, I want to maintain the authority of being a police officer, and I want to be a prosecutor, wear a nice suit and tie, have a nice house, have the respect and status, and if a couple of lowlifes have to go to jail for it, that's a price I'm willing to pay.
Just a quick question, though.
The social justice warriors strike me, and especially at the top, the people that are calling the shots, the, you know, P.Z. Myers and Anita Sarkeesians, they don't mind if they slander and ruin people because this is paying their way.
I've got to say, just Anita Sarkeesian, as far as I can tell, hasn't done that. She is very, very clever. She's a lot more clever than I think people give her credit for. And she, I don't think she is a social justice warrior. I think she's a con artist. And
No doubt. But, you know, con artists and social justice warrior are interchangeable anyway.
Well, this is the thing. I think I've been studying them in their natural habitats. And I think there is a difference. The thing, Anita Sarkeesian, I don't think she is a rabid social justice warrior. I really don't. I think that there is definitely a stripe of person.
There's absolutely no doubt that she doesn't believe she's a snake oil saleswoman. You know that video that made the rounds of her? She was part of some seminar and she's like 23 years old and she's saying, I really learned a lot about marketing and everything from someone's seminar and the way that I can sell my website and blah, 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 blah. She was basically learning Amway. She was part of this multi-level marketing seminar. And it's obvious that somewhere along the way she was thinking, how could I sell myself? Oh, I'll become a feminist. She has a very good spiel. She has good production values, but she's just selling something.
Well, that is exactly Anita Sarkeesian. That's the thing. It was what was the name of the Alex Mandozian? He was literally, when I first learned about him, I went and looked him up, and he's literally there giving a speech saying, "Look, if you have a message, I can teach you how to make so much more money with teleseminars." And it's like, oh, there we go. And that is very much Anita Sarkeesian's spiel. And I know this because she doesn't actually go out of her way overtly to slander people. She does sometimes in tangential and cunning ways, subtle ways. For example, recently she tweeted a picture with four famous, internet famous YouTubers. So we've got 250,000 subscribers or more each. Thunderfurts, Mr. Repsion, Alpha Omega Sin, and some other gentlemen I'm not really familiar with. And she said, whenever a person with 250,000 subscribers or more makes a video regarding me, then the harassment I receive increases exponentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very, very cunning. I mean, she's not saying anything about them. She's just saying whenever a big name talks about her, she receives harassment. And if you care about, you know, a woman receiving harassment, then you won't make videos and criticize. It's a way of trying to silence her enemies and trying to basically solicit donations through sympathy for her feminist frequency campaign.
And in this, she is completely and utterly unoriginal, because Rebecca Watson in the skeptical community did this first. And she's another con artist, because she's skeptic. She has Skeptic International. She's never done anything in skepticism. Her entire shtick is, I'm the girl in skepticism, and people are mean to me.
Yes. And that is you're exactly right. She's not original, because that is her. I'm the girl in gaming, and people are
they
mean
all do
to
this.
But that's the thing, right? The difference, though, is that Anita Sarkeesian doesn't come out all guns blazing, label, attack, on any individuals, because she understands that to people who are not drinking the Kool-Aid, this comes across as very uncouth, very aggressive, and it reflects badly on her. And she wants to be mainstream media credible. Because these people are not mainstream media credible, because you can't go on TV and do what social justice warriors do and expect the majority of people to think, oh, there's a decent chap or a decent fellow or a decent woman or whatever. Because anyone looking at it who hasn't been part of the interactions leading up to it is just going to look at it out of context and go, God, what an awful harridan. So, you know, there is a certain level of self-awareness that she possesses that I think most social justice warriors don't possess. And these are the ones who are the Kool-Aid drinking, power-hungry slanderers, basically. And that's like
our friend PZ Myers.
Now, I actually don't really know much about PZ Myers. I've been told a lot. I've heard the name, but could you just tell me about it, and for the audience as well, obviously.
PZ Myers is an inconsequential little nothing. Oh, maybe I should be more specific. He's a professor of biology, an associate professor of biology at the University of Minnesota at Morris. Morris is a small town with a population of about 5,000 people. So it's basically like being in, you know, the relegated to the outpost. He had in the atheist community, there's what was known as the Four Horsemen, the ones that were taking the lead in the atheist community. They were Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and the late, great Christopher Hitchens. Myers thought he was on the short list to join that company, but that was mostly his delusion. So he runs a website, a blog, on free thought blogs, which is just the most Orwellian title for
I've been to free thought blogs.
And it's called Pharyngula. And he has just gone spiraling into crazy land. I mean, the way that he went from being a semi-respected, he was never a prominent evolutionary biologist. He's just an associate professor who pretends he's bigger than he is. But the way he spiraled down into this sort of echo chamber of his little blog where he strikes people with the ban hammer for the smallest indiscretion. I mean, yeah. He's just a couple of beats away from ending up like Howard Hughes, pissing into mason jars and watching Ice Station Zebra on a continuous loop. I mean, he's just that far away from just going utterly insane. But the thing about Myers is he, like a lot of the social justice warriors, seems to be more interested in lashing out than anything else. And he generally lashes out against his betters, which means virtually everyone. And he's attacked... If you want to have an unsourced accusation made against someone who's prominent in the atheist or skeptical community, you just anonymously send it to PZ Myers and he'll do the dirty work for you. Famously, he posted on his blog, the title was the awkward, "What do you do when someone hands you a hand grenade and pulls the pin?" And it was someone's unsourced, anonymous, which later turned out to be completely bullshit, accusation of rape against Michael Shermer. He didn't do any vetting. There was no due diligence. He seems to be motivated entirely by bad intentions and jealousy. So if you're saying that Anita Sarkeesian, she's clever because she doesn't directly target at people in a way that it could come back on her, yes, then PC Myers is extremely unclever.
See, now that is the difference. That's why I don't think Anita Sarkeesian is actually a social justice warrior, and I think she's a con artist. She's made a lot of money by doing this as well. So, you know, she is. There's no doubt that teleseminars really can make you quite a good deal of money.
Well, famously, she got that $100,000 as a kind of a campaign so that she can go through video games. But I also assume that she's making quite a bit of money off of speaking gigs now.
Well, you know, interestingly, she's not making all that much. We actually know how much because she has a non-profit organization, so she doesn't have to pay tax. She does have to release her company finances and all that sort of jazz. And recently she had to do that. And it was very interesting because she apparently received a death threat in October the 14th.
A very oddly worded death threat, where it was almost humble bragging. Yes, we're targeting Anita Sarkeesian because she is the face of modern feminism. She's just fabulous. She's a great human being, and she's cute and perky. It was oddly worded. It was,
yeah. And it doesn't have any cellulite.
It made you wonder. I mean, when you read it, the first thing that you thought was either this was something that was ginned up by Anita Sarkeesian or someone from that women's center that was also mentioned specifically.
And that's exactly it. It was almost instantly claimed by the police that there was no threat. This was not a legitimate threat. This was just words. And yet she cancelled her talk anyway. And in the fourth quarter, if you look at the quarter, she made very, very little money in the rest of the year and made almost, I think it was over half of the money that the Feminist Frequency, I think they call it a foundation, made in that year was made in the fourth quarter after that death threat was apparently sent to her. So her pulling out of a speech made her something like $250,000, something like that. Mm-hmm. It was in donations.
That's good money for not working.
That's a hell of a good wage for not working. And no tax as well. So, you know, it's...
There's something that we can do then. Because, you know, if you're a really bad musician, you can have people pay you not to play. the Marx Brothers did this routine. Maybe we should start... paying Anita Sarkeesian not to make videos.
She'd
go for it too.
That would actually be terrible for us because the only real weapon we have against Anita Sarkeesian is the fact that nothing she says is true in those videos. Everything is either simply flat wrong, it's cherry picked, or it's just simply completely taken out of context. There's I can't remember who it was, but I was watching an interview with someone, and they were saying something like, yes, Anita Sarkeesian has to spend hours and hours and hours going through these video games to find the examples of sexism. And I was like, well, they're not inherently sexist, are they?
Did a video very early on. In fact, I used a clip of his video in one of mine where he demonstrated that she was just lifting other people's gaming videos without
attribution.
At what point do people just wake up and realize that she's just pulling a con?
Well, I think a lot of people do know that, but the problem is the people who know that aren't the people in the media, and the people in the media, and it all comes back to the fear and power, because the people in the media, there seems to be a culture of fear, that they don't want to rock the boat because it's just a lot easier to believe the victim narrative. You know, it causes no hassle for them if they, oh, look at this poor Anita Sarkeesian. Yeah, there are so many terrible misogynists out there. My goodness, if we just give her 5 minutes of airtime, then, you know, she'll be happy, the feminists will be happy, and the feminists have been doing their communication studies courses, so they all write blogs, and they've got WordPress blogs and all that. They're professional bloggers in a lot of cases. And so, you know, they write clickbait, they know how to get their articles read. They've been trained in university to write clickbait. Just as a quick aside, do you know what they're teaching people in communications courses?
Not journalism, but how to be presentable.
No, not even. They're teaching them two things, at least that I'm aware of. One is Edward Bernays' propaganda techniques, and the second one is I've seen literally where the required reading for the course was Edward Bernays and Saul Alinsky, who wrote Rules for Radicals. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, it's no wonder they're coming out of university writing clickbait and being so efficient at what they do. They are being very well trained.
Yeah. Bernays being the father of modern advertising that based a lot of his stuff off Freud, and I think he was even partnered with Anna Freud at some point.
I think so, and there's a video of him I'm going to be doing a video on this very soon. I say very soon, I'm lazy, it probably won't be very soon, but there's a video of him saying, literally in these words, after World War II, propaganda became a dirty word. And so we needed to repackage it, and so we invented the term public relations instead. And there we go. it's just a different name for an old technique. And So yeah, that's what they're being taught in universities. Instead of being, you know, instead of being institutions of higher education, they're just being cathedrals of propaganda and brain formatting factories almost.
Yeah, and you know, that kind of corruption of language has. We're so used to it now, we almost assume that people are going to do it. You know, an explosion in a nuclear power plant isn't an explosion in a nuclear power plant. It's rapid oxidation. I mean, Orwell would be flipping. But the point of this is, Bernays, is that what he was practicing was very, very cynical stuff.
Yes, yes. It's all about manipulation, all of it.
Yeah. I was at this weekend camping gig, and there's people from, you know, survival and preparedness groups, and some of them, you know, happen to be a little more right-wing than I'm comfortable with. But they were telling me about the way that the legislatures in this country had approached restricting people's right to possess certain firearms and weapons. And oddly enough, when the military would order a certain rifle, it would be called a personal defense weapon. But however, if a civilian tried to buy it, the legislature classified that as an assault rifle.
It's just the bastardization of language to fit an appropriate usage.
And shameless.
Yes, yes. That's the problem, isn't it? Shameless. It's and no one's calling them on it. And this happens, yeah, like you say, in government and now in universities, in a lot of walks of life. This really, really bothers me. Just the repurposing of language of terms to, I don't know, just political correctness, and it's in general, really, isn't it? It alarms me.
Right, the problem is that it's an never-ending process, because especially things that have a kind of a pejorative taint to it, it always has to shift. Moron and idiot began as clinical terms, imbecile as well, and then you couldn't use that, and then you started calling people retarded, and then retarded became too much of a pejorative, you know, and now we went from people being crippled to handicapped to handicapable to differently abled. It always eventually reached the point where words have no meaning whatsoever.
Well, I noticed that with the gays, the gay community, and the language they use, they've come full circle. Now they call themselves queer. And I remember when I was young, you know, and I'm not that old, I'm only 35, but when I was a kid, you were told, don't call them queer, because queer means wrong, you know, bad, different. It's a bad word. You call things that aren't right queer. So you wouldn't want to be called queer, because it makes you sound like you're wrong. Right. So the fact that they've come all the way around now, oh no, I'm not gay, now I'm this, now I'm this, now I'm queer. It's like, really? Okay, fine. You know? Just... Yeah. But for me,
You have to be careful, because between American English and British English, there's sometimes a disconnect in the severity of the terms. Typical of this is the word cunt, which in America is the most horrible, I mean, it's the C word. You're more likely to use any other swear word in its full form than that. Whereas in Britain, it's almost a form of greeting.
Yeah, it can be. It's a lot less impactful.
It has less of a sting, and it's less gendered, it seems.
Oh, yeah, God, yeah. Yeah, oh, God, yeah. It's not... I mean, yeah, it's definitely not necessarily something you consider to be gendered in this country anyway. I mean, Jesus.
But that didn't stop, and you know, it strikes me to the extent that how much of social justice warriors and this sort of fashionista feminist seems to be an American phenomena, whereas the fashionista feminist can tell you how you're not supposed to use the word cunt, even though it has a completely different connotation or denotation for you.
Yeah, it is something that has come from the United States and Canada, and it's made its way over here.
Oh, yeah. Vancouver is like ground zero for a lot of this.
God, I just... Well, it's just all coming from universities. It's gender studies is where it's all come from. And communications degrees, they may as well just call themselves gender studies propaganda degrees. I consider myself liberal and centre-left, but these are just so radically left, I just can't see any kind of relation between me and them. You know, live and let live, let people do what they want as long as they're not hurting each other, you know.
That's having a libertarian tendency, and yeah. They are nothing. I mean, I consider myself to be progressive and left-wing, and, you know, when I go out with these survivalist meetups, and, you know, I proudly argue with right wingers. One guy was a neo-Confederate. I mean, he was making the claim that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery, and I just love that.
There might be an argument for that.
No, actually, actually, if you look at the secession documents from North Carolina, it specifically mentions. Slavery. I can't remember his name. He was Jefferson Davis's vice president. He gave what was called the Cornerstone Speech, and basically he said that the cornerstone of the Confederacy and the system we created was white supremacy. So the claim that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery and it was all about states' rights is nonsense. Right, okay. But, you know, that's the thing, which is why I try not to be put too many political labels on this, because the tendencies of the social justice warriors seems to be the mirror image of what we have in this country to be the Tea Party. You know, these radical oppressed white right wingers who think that Obama is going to take their guns. In fact, when Obama was first elected, the gun sales went through the roof, and for years it was hard to get ammunition because people were buying it up before the hoarders got to it. And it's all perception, because the only thing that Obama has ever done as far as gun restrictions is not renew the assault weapon ban that George W. Bush had put into place. So, I mean, there seems to be, you know, two poles of the same sort of insanity.
I guess
that insanity, really, if you get down to it, is grievance politics.
I just a quick question there. How the one thing I think that we've got to make sure that we don't do is, I think that, I mean, I'm sure I've seen Obama saying how he's not a fan of guns and he wants increased gun restrictions and regulations and whatnot in the United States. I'm not an American citizen, obviously, so I may be wrong when I say this. But how much of his inaction against them has been due to their preemptive paranoia, maybe, and expression of distaste for the idea? You know, I mean, we can't obviously know this, obviously, but...
No, actually, they're engaging, on that kind of Tea Party right wing, they're engaging in the same kind of projection that you get from the social justice. Social justice warriors assume you're a privileged white person, so you're inherently racist and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. They're dealing with you as a type rather than a person.
Yeah.
And with the right-wing Tea Party movement, they assume because Obama was primarily black, among other things, that he was going to do certain things. And it was a script. They were following through with a script that they had written beforehand, and nothing that Obama actually did was going to change that script. Because the way that you among people who fight among themselves, and the Tea Party movement is the same thing as the social justice warriors. If you look at the Atheism Plus forum, they started kicking everyone out until there was nothing left but moderators fighting with each other. I mean, they all resort to cannibalism eventually. Yeah. And so the way that you keep that from happening, you enforce unity by creating enemies.
Well, that's an interesting... So I'm trying to find something on the Reddit. Because it's very, 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 very pertinent to this. Recently, you know who Brianna Wu is, don't you?
Yes.
Recently, recently, she made the mistake of having a lunch or something with someone, a developer who's pro-Gamergate, or at least, you know, pro-Gamergate enough to be concerned about journalistic ethics in the gaming industry because he's part of the gaming industry. And that this has led to her, I can't remember whether she said truce or not, something like that, an ally or truce. And my God, the social justice warriors went ballistic. Personally, I think it would be a great idea. I would be more than happy to, you know, have some sort of truce with Brianna Wu, because she's not a journalist. She can't commit any violations of journalistic ethics. Even if she fucks every journalist in the world, she is not the one committing any ethical violations.
And also, so, too, the entertainment value of Brianna Wu on Steam trying to solicit negative comments about herself and forgetting to log out of her account, I mean, that's priceless.
Idiot. Just idiot. But that's the thing. It shows that she's a provocateur. You know, she knows she is. She does it for political reasons to get coverage. But this is the thing. Brianna Wu, I would be more than happy to get a truce with Brianna Wu because, again, she's just... She cannot be... the subject of what I would like to see Gamergate attacking, addressing. You know, she's just not got the power to do it until she stops being a developer and becomes a journalist, and I don't think that's going to happen. Although maybe it will do one day, but until then, we don't need to worry about it. But that's the thing, she's having a lunch with another developer, and so I'm just sat there thinking, okay, these people are effectively nothing to do with Gamergate, in those technical terms at least. And yet the social justice warriors castigated her. Absolutely, how dare you? You were a traitor, and all of a sudden they're coming out saying, well, this is just white feminist splaining and all this sort of thing. And then they were coming out saying, well, thank God we don't have to be nice about her anymore because her game looks like shit. It does look like shit, but now is not the time to do it. And if you're going to do it like that, then it just makes you... It just comes back to, look how awful these people are.
Yeah. I mean, there is no truce with these people. No. Everything is... What you get is temporary stays of execution. And all it takes is one slip, or they figure that they don't like you, or you're getting too high of a profile, and then you have to be taken down. It's like I said, they tend to immediately resort to cannibalism. And yes, unfortunately, I think it would probably involve some sort of pretentious Asian fusion cooking.
Well, that was the thing. It was savage what they were doing to Brianna Wu. And she didn't deserve it for having lunch with Brad Wardell, I think it was. She was having lunch with. She absolutely didn't deserve it.
But on the other hand...
It shows your point completely.
I've run out of sympathy a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
Because she was more than capable of slandering other people and making outrageous comments or trying to tar an entire community by saying, you know, that she received these threats and then even soliciting themselves. So, not to put so fine a point on it, fuck her.
Yeah, well, no, on a personal level, absolutely. You know, she's used this for as much as she can get out of it, and you know she's done it with gusto. We've got proof of her deliberately trying to provoke outrage against herself so she can play the victim. We've got cast iron proof of that. I agree.
One of the things, and if you've seen some of my way back when I did this video called "Creepy Clowns," about the threat narrative, free thought bullies, and the threat narrative clown horn. And this is why I'm so lacking in sympathy, because there was a time in which these people actually targeted me. They doxed me. One particular clown found an old my old address when I was married, and which the last inhabitant of that abode was my ex-wife, and posted the address and a photograph of it online. And I got Melody Hensley, actually, she got on Twitter and was coyly saying I'm going to complain to your employer about you, although no one gives a living shit what videos I make. So I'm not in the mood to have a truce with these people, because they will destroy people, and yes, they will do it gleefully.
Yes.
And I've often said there is no compromise, there is no reasoning with these people. They have to be destroyed. And
yeah,
you just, not destroyed the way that they destroy people, but mocked out of existence.
Yeah, absolutely. Just given no credence. That's the important thing. Honestly, everything you're saying about what happened to you it's happened to me. so I've been doxxed. I've been, I've had nasty messages.
And this gets back to submitting to them or trying to reconcile with them, which is a lot of people that got doxxed or were threatened kind of backed away. I used it as an opportunity to rub it in their face.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they haven't done. In fact, they're trying to pretend that I'm not there anymore. I thought that was an important lesson to pass on to people, that they will do these terrible things. They will slander you. They will interfere with your employment. They will do whatever is necessary to hurt you on a personal level. And the only response to that is to use it against them.
Well, this brings us to an interesting point.
They're horrible, horrible people.
They absolutely are. The ends justify the means. They absolutely justify the means. And I
to them the ends justify the means.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I was going to say yeah to them, of course. To me, I don't think the ends ever justify the means. I can't think of an example where it's morally justifiable. I mean, it might be justifiable from necessity, but you know, to say that it's a moral action, I think, is very unlikely that I'll be able to find anything like that. But that's the thing. What's your opinion on this? Why, you know, the ends justify the means? What do you make of it? And I mean, is it just an inevitable part of being a social justice warrior?
I think it's part of being a social justice warrior. I think it's having a very narrow mindset. Again, along with the authoritarian mindset is this sort of black and white thinking.
Hmm.
Someone was telling me at this group that I was at, he's a Baltimore detective, and he was saying that when they give the test, they use the same test as they do to become a police officer or an FBI agent, but they'll evaluate it. If your responses tend to be black and white, that's good for being a police officer. It's not good for being an FBI agent, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
There's a black and white mindset that they want for police officers, and the social justice warriors are the same way. They have that kind of a punitive black and white way of thinking. To them the ends justify the means, because they've dehumanized you.
Yeah.
They've dehumanized critics. They're not people. They don't have any rights. They're just types that they're fighting against. And part of this is the facelessness, not just of the internet, but when you start dealing in talking about things like privilege or male privilege, why not just eviscerate people's rights to due process when they're accused of sexual assault, on the theory that if you evaluate an actual claim of sexual assault and find that there are some false accusations, that somehow admitting that there's false accusations is bad for women in general, which is another thing, which is they're playing a zero-sum game.
Absolutely.
There's no little benefit for here or a little bit. It's all or nothing. What's good for them is bad for you, and what's good for you is bad for them.
Even if it's not, even if it's something that really, if you looked at it, if you took a step back and just looked at it from as many angles as you can find, it had no particular bearing on them, they will still treat it as if it does. I mean, I've been recently doing a video series on why the video game press declared gamers to be dead, or over, or whatever language they want. It's try and get rid of the term, the label gamer, because that's the thing about Gamergate. It's, you know, it's gamers, people who considered themselves to be video game enthusiasts, and it seemed very strange that for ideological reasons the video game press would try and end their own audience. But this was the thing. One of the things that in the there's research done by a Marxist feminist academic called Adrienne Shaw, who she was very concerned not to have a plurality of markets. Now, I can't see why a plurality of markets would be a bad thing. If anything, it would seem to be the optimal method of doing things. Because for me, as a, I guess, a libertarian, I would be looking at this thinking, well, live and let live. We'll have what we want over here, it won't interfere with what you have over here, and effectively we will never the twain shall meet. We won't even know each other exists, preferably, because that way everyone wins. But for them, that is a loss for them, somehow. And I can only assume it's power politics that's doing it, because, like you say, it's a zero-sum game. If we get what we want, and even if it means they are getting what they want, us getting what we want as well means they're not getting what they want. And so they, in this research, it's all very, very heavily activist.
Well, it's a purity test, isn't it?
I guess kind of. It was
by appealing to this, once again, going back to a zero-sum game, and appealing to this group here, you're not being pure in your faith to this clique that
you supposedly belong to. How you allow heresy to exist.
Right.
Heresy exists over there, so even if we're being good Christians over here, they're being heretics. So it's our duty to do something about that.
And they need that, and you know, they'll accuse people of being, you know, mealy-mouthed or not being pure in their faith because they're so insecure that they need that constant reinforcement. I mean, part of the whole mindset of social justice warriors is, you know, things have turned against me or things aren't going well because you're misogynistic or you're racist or you're transphobic or you're something or other, rather than admitting that things aren't going their way perhaps because they're weak, ineffectual, untalented, lazy, stupid people.
Yeah, absolutely. People who have also just made bad choices with their lives.
You know, isn't an aspect of this of saying that things have gone against me because of, you know, you racist, transphobic, misogynist people? Isn't there a taint of the post-Weimar Republic stabbed in the back theory that Hitler propagated? It wasn't us good Germans that lost World War II or, you know, the economy collapsed. We were stabbed in the back by Jews.
Yep. it's literally scapegoating. Absolutely. Literally anyone can be blamed for their own personal failings. And there are so many things, like just layers to the characteristics of these social justice warriors. I mean, if you just add up, you've got people who are obsessed with power politics. You've got people who they show a religious zeal for what they're doing. They show very little self-awareness, so they think it's appropriate to attack in the most powerful ways that they have. And they never start low and build up. They go straight for the throat, you know? They have absolutely no concept of moral principles. Absolutely none. What is moral, isn't it? Sorry?
It's sociopathy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
this sort of thing, like other things. I mean, the authoritarian mindset appeals to people who tend to be sociopaths anyway. I mean, there is no compromise. There is no conscience. There's no ability to treat the other people as a human being. There's the politics of personal destruction, all of those things. And you really do need to be lacking in a conscience to engage in that sort of thing. Or you're just spending far too much time on the internet.
Well, no, it's interesting because they can't do that on their own. You know, being a sociopath and even being a group of sociopaths who all agree that, you know, we're all you know, a certain stripe of person. But they also need another stripe of person to enable them, and these are now commonly known as White Knights. What do you make of White Knights?
You know, in a way, you could kind of, they're tapping into what we talked about before, which is the tendency of men to want to curry favor with women and, you know, protect and things like that. But I think after a point, though, it's a lack of moral conviction. You know, like I said, in the skeptical community, when these people invaded, the one thing that skeptics did not engage in was skepticism.
Yep.
That's just weakness.
Well,
fear.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the.
Are you talking specifically about the kind of the white knighting that has a double standard, where if someone who happens to be, say, female comes in and is rude and abrasive and insulting, mm-hmm. and then the minute you give him back what they were giving out, someone steps in and goes, "Oh no, you can't say something like that."
Yeah, and then instead of having the discussion with the woman that you were criticizing, who was, you know, these days I don't even broach accusations of misogyny. If I'm criticizing someone, I'm criticizing them as an individual. You know, mm-hmm. that's the thing. I'll get to another point in a minute. But yeah, the all of a sudden the White Knight jumps in. It is, I receive my validation from defending a woman.
Right.
So it's
noise. I mean, White Knights don't really bother me the way that they seem to bother other people, because I don't even pay attention to them. I mean, they literally have nothing worth listening to.
That's true.
They're not adding anything to the conversation. In fact, what they're acting as is a screen. They're distracting you away from the, you know, leading you away from the original target.
Yeah, that's exactly their function, and
they're walking red herrings.
They are. They absolutely are walking red herrings, and I've seen it in their Twitter profiles where they literally say things like, you know, I I'm paraphrasing, I guess, and they don't literally say this, but in a roundabout way, they say something like, "I'm willing to take the bullet for a woman on the internet by arguing with trolls, because I don't know, they assume
my hero."
Exactly. You know, they can fulfill.
Let me swoon for you.
Exactly. And obviously no woman's ever going to swoon for some fedora-wearing hipster with thick-rimmed glasses. But that's the thing. They need validation from these women, don't they?
But they need validation. And also, you know, it's kind of a, even though I don't like the term, it's sort of like a backdoor way to acting like an alpha male.
Yes, yes. That's, God, there are so many things I want to go over with you. Yes, it's a way of getting one up on the guys that they would otherwise have no way of getting one up on.
Yeah, it's and one thing that, I could see being irritating about White Knights is that they immediately kind of dial things over to these traditional sex roles.
Mm-hmm.
Damsels in distress. Even if she was the aggressor and she was throwing barbs, or that now she becomes a damsel in distress. He's the protector. You're Snidely Whiplash.
One of the point I was going to get to, what I think really fits very nicely here, is the externalization of individual actions to group actions. For example, if you say to, say, I don't know, a woman who's, she's Patricia Hernandez. She promoted her.
Who's she?
She's a writer for Kotaku, who promoted her friend and roommate Anna Anthropy. I think she did reviews, but she promoted her games on Kotaku without telling anyone that they were roommates. It's, you know, a violation of journalistic ethics 101. And so if I then said to Patricia Hernandez, "How dare you? You should be fired for your, you know, malfeasance working for Kotaku." White Knights would jump in and say, "You hate women." It's like, why would you say that? Well, you're attacking a woman. It's like, well, that doesn't mean I hate women, does it? That means I hate one woman. That's not all women. You know, that's. Yeah.
But so, you know, there's a strange thing that goes on with these kind of women, where they, and I don't know where this sort of ego comes from, where they think they are not only able to speak for all women, mm-hmm. and think that a reaction to them is a reaction to all women, but also think that they know men's lives better than men do.
Well, this is the thing. It's the externalization of it onto like the entire demographic that they consider themselves a part of. I can't understand how they think it's appropriate to do it. I would never say that, you know, I represent all white men or, you know, all games players or anything like that. You know, it's a ludicrous, ludicrous thing to do. And yet they do it shamelessly. They will shamelessly say, you're a misogynist. You hate women because you've criticized me, a woman. And it's absurd. I would be embarrassed to do it. You know?
Well, it wouldn't work. I mean, if someone criticized me and I said, well, you just have something against Scottish Italians.
Exactly.
I mean, what kind of sense does that make? And, you know, especially on the internet, and this has actually happened to me, where I got white knighted, and I didn't know that the person I was arguing with, I had no idea what their gender was. Somehow I was supposed to know this so that I could tailor my response appropriately. You know, something that you brought up, which, you know, is something that we see in the atheist and skeptical community, which is getting back to conventions. Mm-hmm. There's the same incestuous clique of people that kept getting hired for speaking gigs. I mean, you kept seeing
Rebecca Watson.
Rebecca Watson, P.Z. Myers, Ophelia Benson, who could, you know, put anyone to sleep. You had people like Greg Laden, who is a professor, I think, of anthropology, and he is the guy who put my address and the photograph of the condo I had on the internet. These same group of people appeared again and again and again, even if they no longer had anything worth saying. And yeah. I think that was the response in the gaming community with Zoe Quinn, not because of her amateur exploits and sexual adventures, but because they realized how incestuous this was. It was the same narrow click of people stroking each other, propping each other up, cutting each other slack, giving each other breaks, giving each other unearned privilege.
Mm.
And yeah, I see that absolutely, and it irritates me when I see a Rolling Stone had a glossary of terms related to MRAs, you know, men's rights activists, which is, you know, if you say anything critical, they could just sort of shout you down by saying, you're an MRA.
But I get it all the time, constantly.
They had a definition of Gamergate as being a bunch of misogynistic trolls. And so I was thinking, well, how did this person from Rolling Stone come across this definition? And I can only think that all of these people are on the same mailing list.
Well, there's probably a lot of truth to that. There was the journalist that was started by Urza Klein, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And that was... I can tell you. It was a secret mailing list that left-wing progressive journalists were all on, and they would all message each other. And in gaming, we had something very similar. It was called Game Journo Pros, where left-wing progressive journalists were all on the same mailing list to enforce ideological orthodoxy on each other.
Is that how they were able to do gamers
are over.
Gamers are over on the same day.
Well, it's hard to tell, because we don't necessarily have
a remarkable coincidence.
Well, no. I think what it is, right, is that they're lazy, and they're stupid, and they're a bunch of fucking sheep. Because you get a couple of people in the community who are more aggressive than others. You've got a woman called Leigh Alexander, who is very, very happy to torch people's careers before they've even really started, because they've had some sort of cross with her, and she's very much a leader in the community. And if she says something, then other people, it's like a cascade effect. They'll see it, and then they'll, like, you know, half an hour later, have their own little blog post written that's similar, but not exactly the same, but towing the party line. And so there's this sort of cascade effect where they all know that they're going to write exactly what she writes, because they're not thinkers. They're parrots. They're echo. It's just, you know, they're a speaker in the echo chamber. And that's exactly what they do. And I'm not sure that they... I mean, I can't be sure that... It's either that they deliberately organized it through the Game Journal Pros list, which is entirely possible, completely possible, but it's also just as possible, in my opinion, that this was down to ideological just orthodoxy.
They intuitively knew what the hierarchy was and how things flow from the top.
Yeah, because they all cited these two articles. One was hers, and this other one was a Tumblr post, of all fucking things, from a guy called Dan Golding, who is an academic who works for this organization is part of an organization called DIGRA. So, yeah, it absolutely flowed from the top. There is a certain point that, in their minds, has a degree of legitimacy, and it literally just cascades down through the echo chamber, where they all echo it out. And, yeah, and so it doesn't necessarily have to have been collusion. It could also just be a terrifying ideological orthodoxy that is, I just find, scary beyond all reason.
Or just laziness, like you said. I mean,
definitely laziness.
As these people are not thinkers, they're more than happy. You know, and we were talking previously about clickbait. When they see this kind of meme, they know it's clickbait.
Yes.
I mean, if they can just get in on the bandwagon, someone will link to them, and they're going to get more hits, and they'll get popularity. Actually saying something that's controversial or questionable, they'll have to defend it, and they won't be able to spend time. You know, on Freethought blogs, I mean, it's amazing the number of people that can blog post 10 times a day. But they're all short. I mean, Ophelia Benson is notorious for having blog posts that consist of just lifting someone else's opinion and then interspersing it with a very thin mortar of her comments and then posting it. It's just, I don't see that as being ideological. I see that as just being lazy.
Well, absolutely. And a lot of the Gamers Are Over articles are very similar. The Kotaku one, I'm just going to get it up a second. Because it's just the laziest fucking thing I've ever seen. And honestly, it's an embarrassment. There are 7, 8 paragraphs in it, right? And these are just, when I say paragraphs, they're sentences. They're just broken up to be easily read. And it's just some guy saying, oh, well, I mean, it's almost apologetic that he has to post this. You know, and literally at the end of it, so he posts the Dan Golding one, The End of Gamers, the Leigh Alexander one, Gamers Don't Have to Be Your Audience, Gamers Are Over, a quote from Leigh Alexander's one, and then he says, note, they're not talking about everyone who plays games or self-identifies as a gamer as being the worst. It's like, why are you apologizing for these articles if you don't agree with them? Don't write this article. Why are you writing this article if you don't agree with them? You either write a rebuttal saying, no, this is wrong, or you just say, you just ignore it. You say, no, it's not even worth covering. It's nonsense. But you don't...
Why would they back off and say, well, I'm not talking about everyone. I'm making a generalization over here, but I'm not... It's almost like this sort of or bigoted meme or attitude where a bigot will say something about a particular group of people, point out, you know, his friend who happens to be black and saying, well, I wasn't talking about you. You're one of the good ones.
Well, this is exactly what they're... Because Luke Plunkett is the guy who wrote this. And you can see from his picture he's a balding guy. You know, he's a social justice warrior.
Does he have a goatee?
He's got kind of like a beard. But he's low on the list. He's low on the hierarchy. And so he is being... There is definitely an ideological hierarchy, and he is being told by his ideological betters, Leigh Alexander and Dan Golden, who have done more work than him in this realm, it's definitely a form of conditioning. He sees them writing these articles, and he knows he has to cover them. They are making statements of faith. This is canonical. What Leigh Alexander and Dan Golden have said, gamers are over. And so him now, as a gaming journalist, he not only has to write exactly what they're writing, toe the party line, but he also has to somehow justify this to the gamers who are his audience. So he's trapped in a rather uncomfortable position, and therefore has to say, well, not everyone who plays games, just, you know, the bad people who play games, they're awful and they're gone. It's like, well, could you point one out? Well, no, because then I'd be pointing directly at you, because that you're the person that Leigh Alexander's talking about. But that would be an uncomfortable thing for me to talk about, so I'd rather just write the bare minimum, and literally, straight off that, he's just like, right, once you're done here, I'll see you next week. That's the end of the article. It's like, there was no point writing this. There was nothing in there. It's just an echo.
Tried not to offend his audience, but he technically fulfilled the directive of the Central Committee.
Yes, that's exactly it. He did his job ideologically, but he knew that it was going to get him in trouble. He absolutely knew it.
Yeah. That's no way to live.
It's weird. But the thing is, working for Kotaku is brazenly... And I don't like saying progressive in such a pejorative manner, because until I met progressives, I thought I was progressive. You know, I'm all for gay marriage and all the, you know, whatever. You know, I'm all for people living their lives as they want, as long as they're not harming others. And I imagine that probably involves a great deal of progressive ideals, but these people call themselves progressives, and I don't want to be in any kind of category that these people are in.
Yeah, but you know, they can call themselves progressive, but that doesn't mean that every country that calls themselves the People's Republic of is actually a republic.
That's true, but you don't go calling your own country the People's Republic, then, do you?
China, the Congo. Oh, that's Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Exactly, but that's the thing. I wouldn't want, I wouldn't want the Democratic Republic of Britain, because that's what people are going to think, because the connotation's been kind of tainted, hasn't it? But that's the thing. He's benefited very much from his status as a social justice warrior by writing for Kotaku. It's not like Luke Plunkett's writing or quote-unquote journalism is merits. It's not noteworthy. You wouldn't notice it. You wouldn't be able to pick it out from a crowd. So he's got there by ass-kissing, I reckon. I mean, I don't know this. I can't prove it. But I can't imagine there's anything particularly special about Luke Plunkett. So I think he's a yes man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's not anything that's particular to, say, gaming. I mean, the amount of people that have lower echelon businesses in the media who just toe the line, I mean, they're legion.
Mm.
But it just happens to be that he's doing it. This might speak to, you know, a greater corruption within the media, but...
I think
my reaction to people doing something like that is kind of visceral, which is just that it's what a horrible, soulless, pathetic way to live. I mean, if you're taking direction for people like that, and I mean, basically, it's being a whore, isn't it? You're whoring yourself out.
Well, I don't even know if it's necessarily being a whore. I think at least whores are independent actors. You know, they perform business transaction, and then they are not controlled by the people they've sold their services to. Afterwards,
right.
You know, but these people...
But a lot of them have pimps, and these people are pimping themselves out.
That's true. These people are slaves, though. There's no getting around it, because, you know, people like Luke Plunkett, they're going to owe their position to who they know and what they... The line that they toe. It's not anything to do with how great they are at what they do. It's not their merit. And so it is a horrible existence. It must be. It's just this kind of the emasculation aspect as well. And I know I don't want to talk about like alpha beta sort of thing, but there is a distinct joy in feminists when they emasculate men. Even if they don't necessarily say it, you can tell on their faces.
And these
men seem to have been, and I don't, again, I'm not saying you have to be a giant alpha male, but just having a backbone.
It would be interesting to see that the culture that they come from, because I mean, the distinct thing in the atheist and skeptical community is, of course, that unless you're an actual doer writing books, like James Randi has tons of books, Michael mm-hmm. Shermer has tons of books out, you could actually make money that way. But as far as the rank and file, there's no money to be made. No one's getting rich on going to conventions. It's more about in-group identity than anything else.
That's absolutely true as well. We've got a perfect example of that, of a man called David Gallant, I don't know how it's pronounced. But he literally, in, I think it was Toronto, he saw people in the indie dev community and thought, wow, they're cool. They have a cool community. I want to join the community. And so he began producing really crappy indie games that obviously don't make any money or anything like that. But he did
it. Was it better than Depression Quest?
Probably not, no. I didn't actually play it, but it looks awful.
So you're saying there could be something worse than Depression Quest?
I am actually saying that. I'm actually saying that David Gallant's video games are probably worse. He did one about being a call center operative. And so I think it's called I Take This Call Every Day or something like that. And he actually it's a paint MS Paint art about taking calls in a call center. How thrilling is that? But he made it because he wanted to be able to call himself an indie dev and join the indie dev community. And he said those words, those exact words, on I think it was Gama Sutra blog, literally not so long ago, where he's just like, all I did is I saw how great the community seemed, and I wanted to join it. It's like, so you're not making games because you want to make art. You're not making games because you enjoy creating things. You're not making games for any reason that I would consider laudable. You're making games because you want to be one of the fucking cool kids. That's the only reason. And just that's the sort of person we're dealing with. And he writes on Gama Sutra. You know, he publishes blogs. He's an expert blogger on Gama Sutra. It's baffling.
Right, because he's playing the part. I mean, just as the way that P.C. Myers plays the part of being an atheist and Rebecca Watson plays the part of being a skeptic, while not knowing what the fuck they're talking about, you get people that are coming into the gaming community. And, you know, coming in from the outside of this, although to pump up my own gamer cred, I should note that way back when I had to reconfigure my auto exec bat and config sys files to get Wolfenstein 3D to run on my computer.
So did I.
Yeah. So I mean, I've got some experience in gaming. I can't wrap my head around the complexities of actually I assume that game development is not something that one person does on their own. One person just couldn't do it. You need a team to actually develop a semi-decent game. Unless you're fabulously talented. To be fair,
there are a lot of tools these days that have done most of the hard work for you. So, I mean... Back in the day, you'd probably have to write your own game engine if you couldn't afford to license a decent one.
So the Romeros are gone now?
Pretty much, actually. And no, that's not true. You've still got the AAA industry who make massive technological marvels in gaming. But you've got a very large and thriving indie scene that right. is possible because the tools are now there for people in small, very small teams to produce surprisingly high fidelity expert work, but David Gallant is not one of those.
No, I mean, it's embarrassing. You see some of the people that posture as a game developer, and that's why I was talking about Zoe Quinn with Depression Quest. I mean, coming from someone on the outside of the gaming community, more or less, I mean, not being up on what's current. It was even, to me, embarrassing for Zoe Quinn to posture as a game developer because she did Depression Quest. And for people who are actually familiar with gaming and what good game development is, that must have been infuriating.
Yeah, I'm developing a video game, and it's been a lot of work, and if Zoe Quinn were a man, she would never have happened. She wouldn't be getting $4,000 a month on Patreon. She wouldn't have been lauded in the video game press by one of the guys she fucked as writing a Twine Darling game, and she wouldn't be given any kind of credence whatsoever. They would not care. But the fact that she's a woman who can play the victim, now they care.
I bet you could name a handful of reputable women game developers off the top of your head. And what a disservice it must be to them.
I can only imagine. I mean, at the beginning of GameGate, one of the people who struck me most was Jennifer Dore, who was producing a game, I think it was Seed something. It wasn't my sort of game, so I didn't really pay attention to the game. But that's not in any way to discredit her talent or capability doing it. And she was, that was one of her criticisms. She was just like, well, I can't get any coverage for my game, and I've worked very hard, and it actually has graphics and gameplay, and you know, it actually qualifies under the technical terms, definitions of what a game is, unlike Depression Quest. And no one would touch her because she wasn't a social justice warrior. She wasn't part of the clique. She wasn't towing the line. She wasn't. Yeah, she wasn't useful. That was the thing. She wasn't playing the victim. So she didn't enable these social justice warrior men to white knight for her and feel validated by serving a woman. You know, she didn't do that. And so they didn't want to know.
Well, I find it fascinating that the women that are actually fulfilling what's supposedly the feminist ideal are the ones that are getting no attention. I mean, they're coming into a community, they're playing by the rules, and they're succeeding on their own initiative. And the ones that get the attention are the incompetent, talentless ones that happen to be able to do the damsel in distress.
It's the modern-day chivalry, isn't it? Have you not noticed how much third waivers hate second waivers?
Oh, yeah. you know, and when they call me anti-feminist or anything, that's just nonsense. You know, absolutely no one is against what was stood for in first wave or even second wave feminism. It was the third wave that came in where there was a big injection of identity politics and scapegoating and all of these things that, you know, oddly, you were talking about white knights. I mean, I intuitively am not able to get in with third wave feminism because I can't denigrate men as a group the way they have. And talking about white knights, I mean, There seems to be a lot more group affinity among women, that you insult one, you insult all, or pretend that way. Guys will sell each other out in a heartbeat.
Well, there's no group affinity. Because I think primarily men generally see themselves as individuals, don't they? Mm-hmm. And so when someone says men, you instantly, if it doesn't directly apply to you, then you just, you don't think you're not in the group that they're talking about. Even if they say men, even if they say all men, you think, well, I don't do that, so I'm not going to get offended. But I do think that, and it's not all women that do this, but there is a certain type of woman who does hear. I mean, maybe to a degree it is all women, but you know, there's a certain kind of woman who hears a woman being criticized and then becomes offended on their behalf because they are also a woman. And I don't know why.
Well, actually, it's a means of manipulation. The way that I like to think of a lot of these third wave feminists and social justice warriors is that they treat all interactions like they do their own personal fucked up relationships. You know, they're basically nagging a community. You know, really, a lot of the impetus behind this constantly saying, I'm under threat, I'm under attack, or I'm offended by what you're saying, is saying to a community, I don't think you really love me. Prove that you love me.
Yeah, I think that that's a really, really, really accurate description of it as well. No, absolutely. I totally agree with that. I don't even have anything to add. I think that's a nail on the head.
there's a very definite kind of personal take that they make on it, and I do think there's something to be said for these people engaging in dysfunctional relationships. You know, you see the lack of social skill of just. You know, he's one of my favorite people. P.Z. Myers, the way that he conducts himself on his blog, ultimately, it's just lashing out. It's a miserable, unhappy, insecure person lashing out against people. And I see a lot of that. A lot of the social justice warrior, it doesn't make sense because there is no rational basis for it. It's just people lashing out. Because they think that the world has wronged them, or they haven't been given their, you know, it's like someone who's raised as a single child, and they're told, "Oh, you're so wonderful, you're so talented, you have so much potential." Yeah, everyone's parent says that if they're halfway decent parents, and then they get out in the real world, and you get your ass kicked because you're not nearly as good as people said you were, and these are people that have not quite gotten to that adult stage yet. They've held on to adolescence and thinking, and you know, a lot of them are still adolescents. I mean, it's a very young phenomena. And I try to think about what kind of life experiences do these people have? And you know, obviously they came from a certain family. They went through a high school where, you know, there's no longer winners or losers. Everyone gets a participant ribbon because everyone's a winner. You know, you don't want to have contact sports or, you know, make people out to be less than the special snowflake they are. Then they go into the university, and now they're given an ideological underpinning for why they're special, why they're better than everyone else, why people are out to get them, why the world is not recognizing them for the wonderful, beautiful, talented people that they are. And what comes after that is lashing out.
Absolutely. You know, that was actually something I was going to bring up earlier. There seemed to be a confluence of social circumstances that appear to all contribute to the situation that we find ourselves in. I'm gonna list a few that I just want your opinion on these really. So first off, the rise of the single parent household, fatherlessness, effectively. This is why they call me an MRA. I'm not. I don't want to take any kind of gendered label like that. But I think I'm a humanist, and so you know I think that history shows us that two-parent households produce healthy children. And I'm not making judgments on the nature of the parents, but I think fatherlessness, especially in boys, produces not every time, but there seems to be a trend that it produces men who are less happy with their position in life. This is just from my own personal experience, really, dealing with people who have come from single parent households. But there is a definite trend of single parent households with the mother raising the children, and then you've got, like you say, the sort of special snowflake syndrome in school where no one can do any wrong, and you've also got Christina Hoff Sommers. I think did she write the War on Boys, or I can't remember if she wrote, there was an article she wrote. But she was saying how boys are being treated like defective girls. And
well,
so
you know, and you get, getting back to my buddy Greg Layden, he actually gave a talk at one of these conferences where he made the claim that that a male is a female fetus poisoned by testosterone. In other words, that males are simply failed females. And I think there's something to that. If you're raised in a fatherless or a household where you're not allowed to experience the even if you say you want to experience maleness, the thing that comes to mind, because we've been conditioned to this, is misbehaving, aggressiveness, things like that. But there's positive aspects to maleness. And so if you're not experiencing that, you end up being treated as and thinking of yourself as a failed female. In fact, in the American school system, they do exactly that. Boys that aren't acting like girls are doped with Ritalin. Rather than boys will be boys, which itself is raised as a pejorative, they're doped up because they're acting like males.
Yep, that's exactly it. There is, and this again, it comes from basically I don't want to say the feminization, because it makes it sound like by definition I'm advocating for the masculinization of something if I say the feminization, but that's not what
I don't think it's feminization and that female attributes are imposed upon them. I think it's more of a vacuum that's created.
Yeah, it's more the desire for basically, there have been trends. I mean, you get very few male teachers these days because everyone's afraid of being called a paedophile.
Right.
And so this has led to schools being increasingly feminized, you know, with lots and lots of women. And women have got a natural tendency to want to make things safe. And boys acting rambunctiously to women isn't particularly safe, especially if they are single mothers or have been raised by single mothers and don't really have much experience of masculinity. And especially if feminists are in control of a lot of media, which they are. There is a lot of feminist media pumping out bullshit about masculinity, toxic masculinity, men are rapists, all this sort of stuff. And so they're sat there. It's a confluence of circumstances, I think.
Even worse is, and it's getting back to the egotism that it's displayed, is that a lot of women presume that they know male experience better than men do.
Yes, absolutely, and male intent as well. But and this is the thing. I have read academic feminist papers where they literally say in the introduction, feminists have argued that men use rape as a form of societal control. And it's like, well, Jesus Christ. That just makes us all deliberate and intentional rapists. It's a miracle that rape's illegal.
Speaking about religious faith, I mean, the whole idea of rape culture is an article of religious faith, because just two guys discussing it amongst themselves. Do we condone rape? Do we think rape? Do we high-five rape? No, we think rapists are
It's despicable. Like you say, the lowest. It's cowardly. You know, and that's masculinity. You know,
Do you think of a rapist as being a real man, an alpha male, someone to emulate? No,
of course not.
In fact, you're a failure.
Exactly. You're a monster. You know,
you're a monster. You failed to protect women. You failed to be able to. I mean, I understand that rape is supposedly about power and not sex, but it is a sexual act. The old saying was that war is politics by other means, or war is a failure of politics. Rape, at some level, is a failure of you behaving like a human being.
Yeah, and being a failure of you behaving like a man. That's the point. Because when you behave like a man, women find you attractive. This is what I was getting back to the very beginning when we were talking. I know it's talking in broad terms, but men act like men because women find that attractive. And so if you can't get a woman by acting like a man, raping someone is not acting like a man, you know. And so this is the thing. I think there are lots of circumstances that come together, and I think there are still more circumstances. This whole thing where you've got a lot of men who have been raised by single mothers, therefore probably innately want female approval. You've got women who have effectively taken over the education system. Boys are being drugged simply for acting like boys. You've got the terrible feminist propaganda of 1 in 5 women will be raped, and all this. There's a rapist behind every car. Your son might be a rapist. All this sort of shit. And it's just. And then you've got the white knights
A lot of this is targeted at children. When you have and this has happened in the American school system, when you get a 6-year-old kissing a girl, and then he's brought up as a sexual abuser. What a horrible thing. You know, way back when I lost my cookies at some Catholic cultists that were handing out flyers for children saying that, you know, you are a wicked sinner, and unless you do this and that, you're going to end up in hell. And I ripped it up and I said, this is just child abuse. Telling a child that they are a sinner, that they're innately sinful. But now, isn't that what we're doing to boys?
Absolutely. It's the new original sin. Privilege. It's the you were born white male, therefore, boom. You've got original sin. You need to be repentant towards women. And this is the thing, right? Now you've
being
got
male is something that you have to transcend.
Exactly. Exactly. They can't stand the idea of being masculine because, my God, that is what they've been trained to hate. That is why Jonathan McIntosh is going on about how awful masculinity is. And you've got these boys. You've got a generation of these boys, millennials. They're 20-something. They've just finished. They're just coming out of university now, sort of thing. And they their whole lives, they've been told, masculinity is awful. They don't have fathers in the homes, or at least a large portion of them don't. And they've been taught time after again, men are evil, men are evil, men are evil. And now they're thinking, well, shit, I don't want to be evil. I'm a nice guy. I love my mum. You know, I love the women around me. I love the women in my family. Why would I want to hurt women? And so if they're being told that any criticism of a woman is misogyny, it's hating women. It's you need to stand up for women. That's what a good man does. He stands up for women. My God, why wouldn't they be white knights? Why wouldn't they be looking for justification and but from these women, validation from these women? And then you've got people who aren't crazy, who think women are equals rather than these terrible, fragile creatures. You know,
treating women as equals is the best way to be labeled a misogynist.
Yeah, it absolutely is. That's the problem, you know, because you are, for them, in their minds, you know, women are so downtrodden, they're oppressed, there's a patriarchy, you know, in their opinion. And so you go, no, patriarchy doesn't exist. You know, why would we have women politicians if there was a patriarchy? They don't care. That's irrelevant. The point is you're criticizing a woman and it's their job. And so, and there is a certain kind of woman who is obviously going to see this and think, well, I can gain personal power from this. I'm going to take advantage. And they do. And I think that is how we have arrived at the position of the social justice warriors as we are now. And they've all done their communication studies degrees. They've been to university. They've been taught. They've been indoctrinated into their ideologies. And they've been taught their tools. And now they are the commanding voices in the media because of fear, like you said. And there we are. That's what I think has happened.
Yeah.
It's quite terrifying, really, isn't it?
I think it's... Where do we go? I mean, how do you take this back? I have no freaking clue. I mean, it's almost like living under an occupation where, you know, you wake up and go, my goodness, we're being controlled by morons. Or con artists, or just these cultists. Kind of spineless cult. Yeah, well, it is a cult. And as far as the media goes, I only attribute the most cynical motives. I don't think they believe any of this. I think it's pandering. I mean, it's the reason why commercials on TV now portray the guy as bumbling and...
I think Twitter has played a large part in this, because if you get 30,000 feminists from across the world, I mean, this is the perfect thing. There was a Twitter petition going around on Twitter amongst the feminists to get Grand Theft Auto 5 pulled from a shop called Target in Australia. You know that it wasn't 30 or 40,000 feminists in Australia who signed this petition, but because you've got Twitter, the internet, and the world, it doesn't matter. Suddenly, it's a very, very loud-sounding voice. Whereas, you know, if you could analyze it in detail, you'd see that most of these feminists probably didn't live in Australia, and none of these feminists were going to buy Grand Theft Auto, and yet still, Target ended up pulling it from their shelves because of just loud voices nagging, basically, on Twitter, right. And it's intimidation, and this is how
businesses and corporations willing to pander to them. I mean, look what happened on Twitter itself. There was a rash of people getting banned from Twitter, and I was one of them, and our account suspended, not banned, but suspended, and we couldn't figure out what the hell it is we did. And then it turns out that Twitter had partnered with this group, Women Wow. Action in the Media.
Yep.
And when you read it's like a two-person operation. They have absolutely no means of vetting all of the charges that were brought about people against people. But if you look on their website, they have this fast-track form that you could fill out. You know, this so and so is a harasser. And then you read the people in charge of this, one woman, I think her name is Friedman, she says, well, you know, we're going to be expanding this beyond the scope of Twitter's actual standards for harassment because we think it would be beneficial to men.
Yeah, it was a net, wasn't it? They were gonna cast the net and see what Twitter picks up, and it's like, wow. So, I mean,
who else would they have this kind of power over? I mean, is Twitter going to now partner with the JDL or the Nation of Islam or some other group so that they can vet people that they think might potentially be harassers or say something untoward? Who else gets seat at this table?
Well, that's the question. I don't think anyone who isn't a woman, because ultimately this is all done under the justification of protecting women as if women are children. And this kind of infantilization of women is something that a certain kind of woman is going to take advantage of. They're going to play up to it, know that they can use it to their advantage, and then they're going to cash in off it, like Randy Harper. They're going to go out like Branawu, play the victim, deliberately provoke people, cash in on it, and then use it to enhance their own status. And out of context, they'll say, I'm a woman who was attacked by horrible, mean gamers. And then people go, oh, no, what can we do to protect a woman? Because every man wants to instinctively protect women. So, yeah, I think it's the most magnificent, just not even con. It's just, it's incredible how it's come about. And I don't think it's necessarily by accident, but I don't think it's necessarily by design either. I think it's, I don't know how we're gonna, I don't know what we can do to get out of it. I really don't.
No, the only thing I can think is just continue to push back and make the case that yeah, we disagree with these people, but we disagree with people on you know, factual basis or the basis of methodology or maybe even values that are being expressed, not because they're we're anti-women or we're against a certain kind of people. I mean, in fact, the philosopher Larry Loudon said that there is no factual disagreements. I mean, if you think about it,
that's true.
No one disagrees on fact. I mean, evolution versus creationism debate can easily be settled by fact. So when people don't want to deal in facts, they'll step it up to methodology, saying, "Well, you know, this is the your methodology is flawed." But ultimately, what it comes down to is values.
Yeah.
I mean, the impetus for creationists isn't necessarily that they want the biblical story of creation, it's because they think evolution is evil, that evolution, and generally they do this by confusing Darwinism with social Darwinism, that they think that evolution leads to certain moral and societal ills.
Yes.
In fact, they even have diagrams of, you know, evolution at the base, branching off into a tree, you know, drug use, promiscuity, all of this, all of this stuff. And when with the social justice warriors, sometimes you end up having these factual arguments, which are just bullshit because it's not going to be decided by fact. You can appeal to methodology. I mean, take the case of Casey Johnson, the guy who did the blog Durham in Wonderland, who dismantled the Duke LaCrosse case. He's a political historian. I think he's got some background in journalism. He recently gave a talk in Ohio University, and he was just dealing with two cases where false accusations were made. The Virginia Tech case that Rolling Stone did an article about, and the Duke LaCrosse case. And he got a bunch of people from this group called Fuck Rape Culture sitting in the front row with T-shirts that said "fuck rape culture," mm-hmm. because you know it's classy that way. And they listened to his speech. They listened to the facts that he gave, the background he gave, his reasoned argument, because all he was arguing for was not that women lie about rape or that rape isn't a problem. He was just arguing for it. There should be due process. That is, there should be a methodology for determining the truth or falsehood, and it shouldn't be conducted by tribunals. But they weren't listening to that because they didn't care about facts. They didn't care about method. What they cared about was values. And they were able to sit there after listening to him saying things like, you know, 1 in 5 women will be raped in the universities, which he pointed out was a higher incidence of rape than the Congo during the Civil War, where rape was used as a means of warfare and assaulting civilian populations.
Yeah,
so it's ludicrous. So I think the thing is that, yeah, it's kind of fun to have factual disagreements. Yeah, we can talk about methodology, that, you know, this study that shows, you know, 1 in 5 women will be raped in university is flawed, and you know the Super Bowl domestic violence hoax and rule of thumb, all of that stuff has no standing. But ultimately, it comes down to values. What values are we expressing? And again, this is the thing that really disheartened me about the skeptical community when these people came in. The skeptics were not practicing skepticism. They not only can abandoned method, they had abandoned the value of skepticism. And maybe we should be having more values-oriented discussions. What do you value? Do you value due process? Do you value fairness? Do you value the methodology of science, which would itself be a value? What do you value in gaming? What is the value of gaming?
Well, this is a very, very interesting thing for us to come across, because almost everything that they do is a breach of a few very important principles to me. The first is practice what you preach. Don't be a
hypocrisy is rampant. Yeah.
Exactly. The second is presumption of innocence. Now, I know that's a bit strange. But to say that someone is a misogynist is to presume that they are full of hate, to presume that they irrationally hate half the human race. That's a horrible thing. That's a horrible guilt to presume about someone. Most people would presume that people don't hate. You presume the minimum scope of whatever evidence you have. So if I were to, say, be having an argument with Brianna Wu or something, I would expect someone to say, wow, he really hates Brianna Wu, not he really hates transgendered people, or he really hates women, because that is just the most extreme side. You've got two extremes. You've got, I either hate the individual Brianna Wu, or I hate all transsexuals. So which one is it going to be? I would be presuming the innocence of that person's motivation, you know, the innocence of their heart, I suppose, to say, well, maybe they just hate that one person rather than they hate everyone.
And you'd have to prove it. You'd have to, and somebody's making a claim that, you know, you're criticizing Brianna Wu because you hate transsexuals generally. Well, prove it. Did you write something? Do they have any evidence for this? I mean, go through the paper trail and, you know, back this up.
Exactly, but 9 out of 10 times you're in a heated discussion. They make things emotional. They're very good at manipulating emotions. There are just so many things. I mean,
well, the angriest I ever got, I think, in any video that I did was the anally inserted grenade, which was a take on P.Z. Meyer's post about, you know, what if someone hands you a grenade, where it came out that the person, the identity of the person who had accused Michael Shermer of rape came out, and then the details of the story of the supposed rape came out, and I'll probably get in trouble by summarizing it, but basically she was all over Shermer, She was one of the organizers of this conference. She decided to celebrate her successful conference by getting shit-faced drunk. Apparently something happened. And what it comes down to is, again, treating women as children. Mm-hmm. The only claim that could be made was, yes, there was something that sexual that happened between her and Michael Shermer. Both of them were drinking, but she could not give consent because she was drunk. And that was the basis for the rape and slandering Shermer. And when you pick it apart in a kind of follow the paper trail, prove it way, it was just infuriating. I mean, yes. And I think that's what's necessary to do. Don't just roll over on it. When someone says to you, you know, you're a transphobe because you're or against transgender because you criticize Brianna Rue, stick on them. Say, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I no one actually does say that to me, but that was just an example, you know. But I agree. If someone like listening is, you know, listening to try and get angles of attack back at them, Micah is absolutely right. If someone is saying you hate women, ask them to fucking prove it. And when they right. say, well, you criticize Anita Sarkeesian, then you can literally just turn around and say, yeah, but that's an individual.
That's
she doesn't represent all women.
The important thing, though, is to, I mean, you have to take a little note from them and do a little self-promoting. I don't mean self-promoting, you know, in a narcissistic way, but maybe it's better to say, you know, disseminating your opinion. When the people in Free Thought blogs and the Atheism Plus attacked me, I was, you know, there's not a lot of readers of those blogs. And someone did the calculation that much more people watched my videos than read the initial thing that I was responding to. And so they realized somewhere along the way that it just wasn't cost effective for them to do this. Because I could have a forum making videos where I could take their stuff, distribute it to a wider audience, and it was a monologue. I mean, once they made an accusation or said something stupid, there was no response they could give. I was off doing a monologue in a video that they couldn't respond to, and they're well after the point, whatever initial stupid little forum post they made or, you know, comment on a blog, that got buried somewhere, and people are still watching the videos.
Absolutely, and then at least it means that we've got something, you know, something with a bit more permanence than they have. So
they have these gaming blogs and magazines. What could the you know, someone who, say, hypothetically is accused of being, you know, misogynistic or transphobic do to push back?
Have you got more time? Because I really need to get a drink because my throat's getting a bit sore.
Okay.
But if you don't mind, like, taking a few questions from the chat or something while I grab one, then...
Well, how do I see that?
Oh, I'll send you a link that you can put in your browser. You'll need to mute the sound or pause it. But you'll see the chat coming up along the side.
Oh, yeah.
They've been talking a lot of shit, probably. So, chat, be nice and ask Micro some questions. He's a guy that I'm sure you can tell has plenty of experience with social justice warriors.
Oh, you're right about having to mute the sound.
Yeah, but I'll be back in as soon as I can be back because I'm really, really enjoying this conversation.
Okay. All right, let me see. Do we have any questions that I can actually answer? How big is your dick? Well, yeah, thanks. Why? Yeah. Why am I such a fag? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chat is a trap. Thank you, Admiral Akbar. Don't look, it's a trap. Don't look at the chat. Wait, I actually saw what might have been like a pertinent question. What are your aims in criticizing freethought blogs? They are just massive disseminators of horseshit. What is the origin of the term shitlords? Oh, you know, I actually once knew that. I think it was just a feminist way of denigrating men's rights people. Snack bar? Yeah, I do have a video in the work. I pretty much got the voiceover written. Now I just have to go back and slap it together. But I had to take a few days off to go winter camping because I'm a glutton for punishment. I met Sargon on the internet. The worst social justice warrior story I've heard recently. I don't know. I haven't been paying much attention to them recently. I think the funniest one was with Brianna Wu trying to gin up some comments about herself and forgetting to log out of her Steam account.
That was just my favorite thing ever. Sorry, I'm back now.
Okay.
No, sorry, if you carry on.
Oh, someone was asking me about MGTOW, men going their own way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I on one hand, I think it's kind of a, you know, it's people who think that, you know, if you can't win, don't play the game.
Yeah.
But I think generally, I mean, as long as you do it in such a, I think it's a good thing for guys to concentrate on doing things that are good for them, fulfill them, not worrying about doing things just to please women. And, you know, I think in a strange way, MGTOWs, by being MGTOWs and working on themselves and doing things that interest themselves, would probably be more attractive to women, and then they would stop being MGTOWs.
Absolutely. And one of the things I think MGTOWs are actually a very, very essential thing to give men an option, because it's very, very difficult to go against the grain in any society if you're the only person doing it.
Someone asked me what games I play. Well, right now I'm stuck in the tunnel in Metro 2033.
What's Metro 2033?
Is that the name of it? I probably forgot the name. It's it takes place in a post-apocalyptic Soviet Russia, and you're pretty much down in the underground.
Right.
And Metro 2033 Redux. Someone suggested that, so I started playing that, and then there's just a point where I ran out of shotgun shells and just kept running out of them, and I keep getting eaten.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool, actually. Mm-hmm. As any single player. God damn. I've been playing a game called 7 Days to Die recently, which is kind of like a video game version of The Walking Dead.
Someone wants to know which tunnel. The first tunnel. That's what tunnel. Oh, look at that. Yeah, stuck in the tunnel. Okay, I'm going between two stations. The first time you do it, I'm just stuck. Bite me. Don't make me feel worse about it than I already do.
Would you two please finish the Sarkeesian effect? Oh, good God. Have you heard of the Sarkeesian effect?
I don't know what to make of those guys. Are they just sort of douchebag self-promoters, or?
Well, I mean, I don't know either, really. I've talked to Jordan maybe I've said like 10 sentences to him on Twitter via message. And I had a conversation like this one with Davis Arini, which honestly I enjoyed. It was a fun conversation. But I don't know them, you know. I wouldn't be able to say I know them. And I would have thought when Jordan first put his video out saying, "Oh, we've parted ways," or whatever, I thought that it would be something that Arini had done, because I don't know why, really. I don't know, but it's just I didn't expect Jordan to be reacting quite so emotionally, but that's because I didn't know him, you know, I don't know him. And from what Arini's put on his blog, it kind of seems that Jordan, I don't know, it just seems personal. Rather than... In fact, it kind of brings me back to a point I wanted to make earlier about the flagrant lies about statistics. Like the 1 in 5, you were saying it would be a higher rape rate than the Congo. And that's obviously true, and it's obviously not 1 in 5. In fact, I had a study that I linked in a video a while ago that showed that it was actually 0.03 in 5 women were raped in colleges, which is lower than the general population. So the hysteria of rapes on campuses are just absurd. It's ridiculous for it to be, you know, I mean, like being hysterical about tiger attacks. But this is the thing. They lie. They have lied about these statistics.
Well, someone's asking, what's the most dangerous thing about SJW? And I think it's, you know, the truth doesn't matter. I mean,
yeah,
there's,
it's the lies.
It is a script that they've written in advance. I mean, it's like the thing, you know, it's the polar end of, you know, the Tea Party movement. They get a script because they think it's going to appeal to the rank and file, and they're going to follow it come what may. There is literally no way to talk anyone out of this 1 in 5 statistic. It is a convenient lie, it is a useful lie, and they will repeat it as many times as necessary. And that's the inherent danger. It is sophistry. It is really this SJWs come down to the truth is whatever you can make people believe.
Absolutely, it's there are a bunch of points here. The narrative is the most dangerous weapon I think the social justice warriors have, but it's also one of the biggest weaknesses. One of the things that with Gamergate that they've been trying to push and they've managed to do it, and this has got to the point where everyone's pissed off about it. I don't know whether you heard about the Special Victims Unit Law and Order episode about gamers. Did you see
that? I saw that clip, and their take on it was the thing with Gamergate was that there were actual gamers raping women in restrooms.
Yeah, and trying to get gamers out of...
And then they can kind of confuse gaming with Anonymous, and there were, mm-hmm. you know, guys with masks on saying, no, we're all...
Yeah, exactly. Game on, New York Police Department. So, what do you think? Do you think they're not Islamic terrorists? They don't think they're getting some kind of virgins in heaven when they die? You know, it's absurd. But that was the thing. They've constructed this ridiculous narrative where... as a weapon, this is a weapon against gamers, is a way of never having to compromise or even listen to gamers. They've decided, right, if we can cherry pick events that we can turn around and say, these confirm, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that gamers are misogynistic shitlords who are terrorists, who are worse than ISIS, who are trying to force women out of the video game industry, and my God, we're the only people who can save them, us brave white knights.
Yeah.
Then they construct this narrative, and they cling to it. They make sure it's easy to repeat. It's always very easy to get from point A to B to C to D.
I think the motive is very similar to what motivated people to form Atheism Plus. That is, mm-hmm. you know, if you want to do social justice, if you want to work for any number of causes, then there's already organizations in existence where you could work on that cause. But people like, you know, Myers and Watson and everything, they didn't want to do that because they would have to start at the bottom, you know, work their way up. It was sort of something ready-made where people could come into a community and say, we're in charge now. And it's not for nothing that... It seems skepticism was identified as a very male-oriented community. You know, the leading lights were... And I think it was the same thing with gaming, which is it was identified as a male-oriented community. And so, therefore, it was ripe for, you know, the pod people to come in.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, they're never trying to take over knitting or something that is not male-oriented or identified as male-oriented.
No,
because they would have no power there. Their main weapon is you want to feel good about yourself and you don't want to think that you hate women. Therefore, do as we say. And obviously that's not going to work with a bunch of old ladies in a sewing circle. So,
and you know, there is something to... In one of the groups that I belong to, we would go camping in an area down in southern Virginia where there were habituated black bears. And you know, they're not big like grizzlies, but the difference with that... Grizzly bears will attack you because it's a territorial thing. They'll slap you around and maybe they might turn over into predation. Mm-hmm. Black bears, when they attack you, it's because they're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
So we would carry firearms. I'd have a shotgun. And some women came into the group and said to us, you know, they really liked the group. They liked doing, you know, primitive skills and stuff like that. But they didn't like all the firearms. And so I said to this woman, I said, well, you know, there's these bears here, so I'll make a deal with you. If a bear attacks anyone else, I'll shoot it. If it attacks you, I won't. I thought that was a reasonable compromise.
But I think so.
It's amazing how what it demonstrates is people coming into a community and having some sort of arrogance of thinking that they're able to call, rather than working their way up through the community and learning, you know, what's what. I mean, these people came into the community, and before they learned any skills, that they had any kind of talent or knowledge, assumed that now they were calling the shots.
Yeah, it's absolutely entitlement. I mean, you've got Laurie Penny, who's this really annoying woman who wrote an article called On Nerd Entitlement. And she basically went through the article ripping on nerds about being entitled to the spaces that they paid for.
That's very brave. I mean, it's exactly. She obviously thought it... I mean, and she's not even talking about gamers or a male community. She's targeting nerds, something that she's already, you know, categorized as a soft target.
And as if they, you know, they paid the money. They put the time in going to whatever conventions or whatever spaces they wanted to create. They put the money in to make sure that these industries that support these spaces and use these spaces exist and have thrived and profited. And now she's like, oh, they're entitled. Yeah, they're fucking entitled. They're absolutely entitled. They've put the time and effort in. What have you done? Nothing. You've come in, you've seen someone build something out of nothing and been like, maybe I could take advantage of that. Maybe I could co-opt that. That's your entitlement that you are obviously projecting onto them, whereas they have a legitimate entitlement to it. Fuck off. It infuriates me. I can't believe the audacity of it.
And sometimes this sort of attitude, it's so... You know, I'm talking about men being misogynistic or something, but this entitlement is so reflective. Now, I work in a building that's the second largest federal building besides the Pentagon. It's huge. But, you know, there's rhyme or reason to getting around. And so I'm going into one office, and these two women walk past me, and they're looking around, and I said, can I help you? And they said, oh, yeah, we're looking for the elevator. I said, well, it's simple. It's down the hall there and just go to the right. It's in that little alcove. Rather, in lieu of saying thank you or anything, they take two steps past me, and one of them says, I told you this building was designed by a male.
What?
It doesn't even make any sense. It was just a kind of reflexive, let's male bash between girls. And I said to, as they walked by, I said to him, I'm sorry I helped you if you were going to say something misandrist.
I would have just wanted, and every building you've ever been in is designed by men.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, this building was designed by men, it was built by men, and when something goes wrong, probably a guy will fix it.
Yeah, exactly. So you look down on that, you know, you look down your nose at that, love, you know. I mean, if it wasn't for us, where would you be living? But hey, I can't say yes because I never built anything. So, you know, but it's the principle though. It really pisses me off. It's the entitlement. It's just palpable, absolutely palpable.
But would you you know, if you bought something at a Jewish-owned store, a bodega in New York, and take two steps out and say, you know, he Jewed me out of, you know, he Jewed me down, or, you know, whatever they say, would you actually say something like that? You would have to be a massive asshole. Yeah. I mean, you have to be the most bigoted, stupid, socially awkward fuck on the planet. Yet these two women thought nothing of, well within earshot, saying, "Oh, yeah, I told you this building was designed by a man."
I don't even think that sort of thing registers. That's the thing.
It's not considered to be bigoted. I mean, it's. Yeah, you know. Then again, you know, because you know, I work in tech and everything, and I wear a dress shirt, but I luckily haven't had to wear a tie in eons. You know, they probably just thought of me as lower level, that they were talking over my head. You know, I notice that very often that women will, as I said before, they'll look up, they see the men in position of authority. Mm-hmm. And the men that are not at that level are either invisible or considered to be a threat.
What's the whose law is it that then if I can't remember, it's, you know, some colloquial law of the internet, that probably of the manosphere, that says if there's no benefit to the interaction between a man and a woman, the woman doesn't let it happen.
Oh yeah, I know.
I can't remember the name of it, but yeah, there's a lot of truth.
It's some French-sounding name, Bergelot's Law, or
yeah, something like that.
Someone in the comments will have it.
Yeah, come on, guys. But
come on. Stop asking me the size of my dick and get to doing some research.
Yeah, stop talking about the Jews. Get on
there. Pussy hounds? No, they're not doing it. Patriarchy and aliens.
Now, there's a bit of a delay on the chat, so...
Oh, do you believe that 6 trillion Jews died? What the fuck? Well, anyway, okay, yeah. We'll just roll with it.
What I'm talking about. I think there is truth to that.
It might be some truth. Then again, you know, I don't want to say it's the product of bitterness, I just don't like stuff like that that would become sort of the mirror image of what social justice warriors do and use as an excuse.
Cross generalizations that kind of cement themselves into methods of thought reflexively.
Oh, someone had it. Not Brad.
Refault.
Refault's law. Refault's law. In between comments about Jews and horse dick, someone actually knew what it was.
Yeah. That's I don't even think it's necessarily malicious, but to a certain type of woman who, I guess, and again, I'm wondering if this is the sort of social and sort of cultural conditioning of the reverse of the white knight. The person who has been raised by the woman who has been raised by a single mother in a system that is very concerned with men not being men and women being treated like princesses and not being ever challenged and whatnot. Why wouldn't she be entitled? Why wouldn't she look upwards?
And you get this in women responding to comments on blogs or YouTubers. There's going to be a certain percentage of people who are trolling or shit talking, and you know, you just take that in stride. I mean, like the comments here on this conversation. I mean, there's nothing that's actually going to offend me, no matter how much someone writes Jews with horse dicks. I mean, there's going to be a fair amount of shit talking, and a lot of it is, you know, one-upmanship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's who Refault Jewish horse dick, but you know, but they use that as a means of controlling the entire conversation. But they know, you know, how do you do that? I mean, unless you give over complete control to them, how do you prevent the untoward remark on the internet?
Well, you can't. Unless you've got Wham, of course, in which you censor all kind of speech and you completely abandon the principles that the West is built on, which I'm personally not prepared to do. Which is, honestly, it's kind of why I run a YouTube channel. You know, it's just so I've got some sort of voice in the public dialogue, because goddamn, I'm very tired of all of this going on so smoothly for the people I disagree with.
Yeah. You know, YouTube is a great venue because one thing that we noticed is that the social justice warriors are very bad about doing things that actually take some modicum of learning and talent.
Yes.
Something that has a learning curve, like doing YouTube videos or game development. So if you can find a venue that because of their incompetence, they're sort of left out of the conversation. I mean, I'm trying to think of anyone who does. There's so many YouTubers that you can I could point to in the atheist and skeptical community that are just doing hysterically funny and or just delving, driving stuff. But I can't think of any social justice warrior who could do anything really besides bitch on comments. So that's probably the best medium for going after these people.
If you
can do it in an entertaining, funny, thoughtful sort of way.
I think, very interestingly, YouTube has very much become the forum of public debate these days, of intellectual debate. It's especially with viral videos. I know that most videos that go viral are crap, like, you know, tat videos. But you do get some videos that's, you know, they can influence a large number of people. And I think that one thing that I find very amusing is that feminists hate the comment sections on YouTube. They hate them. They think they are the worst drivel in the world. I love my comment sections on my videos. Yeah. I read all my comments, and, you know, there are people who disagree with me, there are people who agree with me. There are people like, man, you don't know this, you don't know that, and therefore you need to learn these things, and I'm like, great, thank you. Because that is something I can now add to my arsenal. I am less wrong than I was a minute ago. Now, you know, I've learned something. I think comment sections are excellent. And
well, you can tell the social justice warrior videos because they say comments are disabled.
Disabled, yeah, exactly. They're afraid to have their worldview challenged. But that's the thing. They have lost the YouTube battle. You know, every time the MRAs are coming or something. It's like, no, you're just wrong. You know, people can show you that you're wrong, and if you disable your comments, they're going to make a video about it and make you look like a tit in perpetuity. So, you know, you go ahead.
I mean, Mr. Apesian, when he did some videos, and the first reaction that Anita Sarkeesian had was to start blocking people from commenting on her videos. And I think she eventually went over to just disabling all comments.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, was a double-edged sword for her, because on one hand she didn't want to hear it, anyone being critical of her. On the other hand, she wanted to mine all the negative comments that she could, especially when people stepped over the edge a bit.
Absolutely, she, being the professional victim, she needs to find the few comments to cherry pick where someone's obviously blowing off steam at her. Because she's pissed them off by telling them how awful they are.
Yeah. I mean,
without even knowing them. Amazingly, that'll piss people off. And that's, you know, that's just part of a professional victim shtick.
I know that YouTubers like Thunderfoot, and there's one guy, Integral Math, who the way that, especially like Integral Math, he can take
just
one of the idiotic remark, Justicar, one of these idiotic remarks, and just dismantle it with a scalpel. It's beautiful to watch. They have no response. Maybe I haven't been watching. I don't think there's a case where some social justice warrior made some idiotic remark or idiotic blog post and got a YouTube response taking it apart. I don't think anyone has ever responded with their own video. I don't think they can do it.
There is a certain breed of male feminist who have taken to YouTube. I've been recently, and honestly, I've just got to the point. And this brings me back to a point I wanted to make earlier. Actually, is the lies about statistics? They will lie. They will fucking lie brazenly, and I am just sick to the back teeth of it because for two reasons, right? I was watching a video by a guy called Andrew Clavin. Now, he's a right-wing gentleman, and I don't like using the phrase right-wing pejoratively. It really annoys me because the progressives have got to the point where anything from the right-wing is wrong. It's ad hominem. It's just instantly wrong and can't be considered. And I don't like that. But also, I'm not right-wing, and so I don't like giving them undue ammunition. And I was watching a video of his, because he's quite a funny man, and he was saying, you know, liberals say this because liberals lie. And that is a statement of truth. They fucking do. They lie constantly. Absolutely, it infuriates me. I just wish they would just stop lying because you're giving them ammunition. But and even then, there's this cadre of sort of, I don't know, I just call them the Mangina crew because I don't really have a better name for them. But they've got maybe, I don't know, 500 subscribers between them. And they're they are the most reactionary male feminists you've ever seen. They can't stand to have anything challenged.
And you also have to take into account that, you know, a lot of them are not particularly intelligent.
I think that's, you know what, I'm not sure that's fair, because some of them are. I think the problem is that they've been conditioned, so they must see things in a certain way, regardless of what the actual facts of the matter are telling them. And like with the narrative, they'll cherry pick certain things that they think forms a coherent narrative and conveniently ignore other things that don't. And I just wish they would just calm their tits, basically. You know, but they sit there and lie. I mean, there's this one guy called King Jong Targaryen, which I did a response to, because I wanted to show him that, look, he's got like 200 subscribers, but I don't care about the number of subscribers. I care about what he's saying. And I've seen him in comments being like, I'm a big fan of history. I'm well read in history. I'm not a professor of history or anything like that, and I've never claimed to be. And he's like, you're a charlatan. It's like, how can I be a charlatan if I'm not claiming to be anything? You know, I'm just someone who has read stuff, and, you know, I'm not saying I'm a professor. And he's like, well, you're a charlatan. It's like, well, I can't be a charlatan. He's like, okay, well, you claimed that the Egyptians were Caucasian. It's like, where did I claim that? And then he's like, oh, well, I guess not. You know, I challenged him. He couldn't prove it, and yet he still claims it afterwards. And I'm just like, for fuck's sake, you know, would you just listen to yourselves lying, and I just, it's got to the point now where I'm just like, right, I'm not even going to deal with them. I like to address my critics. If someone's like, man, you're wrong on this, I want to address it because I don't want to be wrong on a certain thing. But good God, these people are just fucking liars. Sorry, well, I'm getting off on one.
When I say they're unintelligent, I liken it to someone who is like a Bible-thumping Christian. Again, getting back to, this is an article of faith. I mean, someone who believes ludicrous crap from the Bible as literal truth, I mean, it's not like they're not functional human beings. They're able to, like, buy houses and drive cars and, not crap their pants on a regular basis. It's there's this one area where they've just abdicated responsibility to be a critical thinker, because it's convenient for them, or it makes them feel better, or it gives them status. And I think it's the same case with, you know, these white knights and other people. They could be perfectly functional and hold jobs and hit the toilet on a regular basis, but there's this one area where they've decided that they're just going to throw critical thinking out the window. You know, one of the hardest things that you can do is, it's typical, you ever notice that the best critiques of religion are religious people when they critique other religions?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
The fundamentalist Christians are brilliant when it comes to, you know, critiquing Islam or Catholicism, unless you're, you know, Jack Trick and Jack Chick and you're making those crappy cartoon books. But it's this, but they can't turn that inquiry around on themselves. They've carved out an exemption for themselves.
Now this is where I'm wondering how much of the circumstances that I was talking about earlier come in, where, you know, the raised by single parents in a school system that despises them and their gender, and, you know, that sort of thing. I wonder. I mean, because that's the thing. They're not. I've watched the videos, and a lot of them aren't stupid, as in, you know, not like actually stupid people who can't grasp concepts. It's more a willful ignorance to refuse to grasp a concept, and this is due to their bias. You know, they're very, very strong bias in favor of, in these cases, feminism, the ones I'm talking about. And so, any kind of really strong ideological bias, I'm heavily suspicious of, because I really don't like ideologies. I find them. Just terrible things are done in the name of ideology. Someone has to be sacrificed on the altar, and I don't like that.
Right.
That's all, you know. And so,
There was a book by his name was Edmund Cohen. It's called The Mind of the Bible Believer. Mm-hmm. And what he said is applicable to ideologies too, other articles of faith, which is that when you have a conversation with a Bible believer, you find that words have a very different meaning. You know, you could be arguing about truth, and you have an idea of truth as being, you know, empirically verifiable objective fact. They think truth is their dogma. So you're talking at cross purposes, and when you're dealing with someone who's ideological, you'll find that they're almost using language in a different way than you are, which is, you know, allows you to talk at cross purposes. I mean, the very idea that these people label themselves as for social justice, what does that even mean?
Well, it's one of those
Orwellian phrases.
Yeah, they take something you couldn't possibly sound like you're against.
Right, you know? It's like the Patriot Act. I mean,
exactly.
If you're not patriotic, are you? Yeah, if Congress wanted to pass the most evil, draconian law, they would be calling it the Kittens and Puppies Act.
Absolutely. It's and it's entirely deliberate, and it's part of their propaganda game, because ultimately the people doing this are propagandists, and they know it. In fact, you know, I'm not even saying they know it. I think a lot of them don't know it. I don't know if they're aware of the origins of the dogma that they spout and the ideology that they follow. I'm really not. But I think a lot of them see the advantage in adopting it, and so go with it anyway.
I think a lot of these people that are true believers in this, the only thing I can think of is they have very narrow, sheltered lives. That they've... you know, when they talk about things like male privilege, you know, because you're a white male, you're privileged, or just male in general, you're privileged.
They
obviously have a very selective view of how people live their lives. I mean, my background is pure working class. I mean,
same
my. Here. Great grandfather pushed a fruit cart in Brooklyn. His son loaded bags of cement for 40 years and swept up. My dad was joined the Air Force at 17 to get out of Brooklyn.
My dad did the same thing.
Not Brooklyn, but the same thing. And then he worked his way up from a sea mechanic until he retired as an instructor at Consolidated Edison, the electrical utility. I mean, there's not a lot of privilege in that.
Well, I'm very much the same. My family background is insanely working class. My mum's side of the family are Welsh miners from the Rhondda Valleys, and my dad's side of the family are farmers.
Bunch of pansies. What do they know?
Exactly.
Mining. What a Christian life.
Exactly. You know, my nan told me stories about when they were kids. You couldn't tell whose father was who because they'd be coming back from the mines, they'd be coming down the mountains covered in coal dust, and they were all just black as night. And you couldn't. I'm racist now. Now you couldn't tell who was who until they came to the actual house.
How is black as night racist?
Oh, I don't know. Everything's bloody racist. Oh, okay. You know what I mean? But yeah, no. So yeah. And my dad joined the Air Force at 16, the RAF at 16, because he lived on a council estate in Yeovil, and that was literally the only option he really had for a stable career that would have got him out of a council estate. And so I got to have a nice middle-class lifestyle based on my sergeant in the RAF father.
Yeah.
So that probably explains my accent, too.
Well, that too. Well, and my grandmother, my grandfather, my mother's side was captured in St. Valerian Co. in 1940, and he spent 6 years in a German. He was a 51st Highland Cameron, Queen's Own Regiment, and spent 6 years in a German POW camp.
Well, that sounds privileged to me.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, it's a different generation because. During that period, the Greatest Generation, when my mother grew up during the London Blitz, I mean, she remembers having a Mickey Mouse gas mask. My grandmother, when my grandfather was in a POW camp, she was working in an armaments factory. Mm-hmm. You know, there was women were more than capable of doing the job that men did. And it was necessary.
They had to.
So, you know, I contrast that with these social justice warrior types where, for the life of me, I'm trying to look at whether or not these people had a real job in their lives.
Imagine Melody Hensley having to work in a factory.
No, she could. You know, they would collapse. They couldn't do it. I mean...
Absolutely.
First of all, social justice warriors, they seem to be chronically underemployed, which gives them a lot of time for, you know, opining on blogs and things like that.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to be much out. I mean, talking about gamers being isolated Cheeto eaters, you know, as their stereotype, but
ironically,
these people must have no damn life that I know of.
Well, that's a very interesting thing as well, because they generally seem to come from money. Plenty of them come from money. You've got, for example, Brianna Wu, who bragged that, you know, when she first set up her game studio, her millionaire entrepreneur parents gave her $200,000 to start up her business with. I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, and she pissed it away. And then you've got, Arthur Chu won hundreds of thousands of dollars on Jeopardy. And then you've got Jonathan McIntosh, the writer of Feminist Frequency, whose dad has a vacation home on the San Juan Islands. And they come from money. They all
money. Because working class people cannot take, you know, can't go in and take one of these identity politics degrees.
Exactly. And you know, it costs money to do a pointless degree. A degree that's not going to get you any money out of the end of it. And so, and that's the thing. And so it comes back to everything they say is projection. You're privileged. No, you are
privileged.
No, yeah. I didn't come from money.
You know, maybe, and you know, there has to be, people should be more proactive in pointing this out to them. That they are the children of privilege. And, you know, someone posted something, some woman posted something about men on a construction site. The forklift operator was looking at my ass as I walked away. It was some random comment. And I commented back saying, you know, I worked in a lumberyard in high school and in college, and I know how to drive a forklift. And I'll tell you something. The one thing that the forklift operator is not looking at is your ass.
That's true. Yeah,
because there's penalties for failure working a forklift. I mean, it's something.
Yeah, he's doing his job.
Right, but it's the attitude. You know, here's one thing that never really comes up, because they like to talk about gender, and they like to talk about sexuality and the orientation and things like that. What never comes up is class. And as you were saying, this is a very class-oriented phenomena, and they spend an awful lot of time denigrating working-class people, particularly working-class men.
If class came up, then they'd lose that debate instantly.
They never ever want to talk about class, because, you know, I was not aware that Brianna Wu comes from money, and her parents gave her $200,000 that she squandered.
Yeah, she absolutely pissed it away, apparently. And yeah, and she's the only reason we know this is because she bragged about it. She tweeted about how, the same with McIntosh, she tweeted about these things, so they're a matter of public record now, you know. And it's incredible. Like, exactly, that's a great point, that class never comes up, because, God forbid, because they know they'll lose that. They know they're instantly going to lose that debate. And
I've pointed it out several times in my video. I mean, I'm proudly from blue-collar background, and a lot of my perspective comes from that, the good and the bad, and seeing my father described himself as a one-man money-making machine, because we were able to have, growing up on Long Island, we had a boat, we went skiing, we had a nice house, we did all these things. But my father basically worked two jobs for 30 years. He had his own electrical contracting business, and he worked for Con Edison. I mean, his way of expressing love was making money. And when he was there, we would do things like go out on the boat and things like that. But he was very task oriented to that. So our privilege came at his expense.
But that's quite common for people who have come from poor families. You know, they understand that being able to buy things for people is an expression of affection. You know, because when they were a kid, my dad tells me stories about how him and his five brothers lived in a bloody caravan, and I'm just thinking, Christ, so, you know, when I was growing up, I was living in a nice, comfortable house. I didn't have anything to worry about.
We had to go to the mill half an hour before we went to bed.
Exactly. You know.
The so Four Yorkshiremen sketch.
Yeah, he was piss poor. Piss poor when he was a kid. And that's why he joined the RAF, you know. And it was like, yeah. I'm personally not working class, but all, you know, my family background absolutely is. So, it's just amazing, isn't it?
I was not encouraged to not be working class. I mean, it was expected that I had a dirty, menial, difficult job like working in a lumberyard. I mean, it was something that does give you character, you know, out in the middle of winter, breaking apart 2x4s with a crowbar because they're frozen together, and that's part of your job. So, yeah, it does offend me a lot to have these, like you were saying, a lot of them being children of privilege. And because they're children of privilege, they're sort of like, you know, kind of like the British aristocracy, you know, frivolous.
Yep.
And thinking that they get to tell other people how to live.
And thinking that they're better people because of it.
Yeah.
Well. Just, you know, just fucking...
Talking about unearned privilege.
Yeah, exactly. The giant irony of it. It just... You would think it would just kind of collapse in on itself at some point, wouldn't you?
Well, that's, you know, it. We just have to beat the banner of class warfare more often.
I think we should, actually. I don't like bringing it up, though. That's the thing. You know, it's not seemly, is it? You know, you don't want to think of yourself like that, generally, I guess. You know, it's just... You don't want to think of yourself as the sort of person who thinks in terms of class warfare.
There's a way out of that, because, you know, one of the ways that they explain away their hypocrisy, and, you know, they can say horrible things to people, but people can't respond to them, is because they consider themselves to be oppressed. They're punching up. Punching up is always good.
Now,
punching down is bad. But in the case of class, I would be punching up at them. Mm. And all they can do is punch down. If they're coming from, if they're children of privilege, if they were able to get $200,000 from their parents or whatever, you know, other little sick stories is, then they're just punching down at people. Once again, they're violating their own quasi-ethics.
Yeah, I think that is actually a great, because one of the things that I think that they can't rationalize that away. They can't rationalize, because like with all things, oh, it says power, privilege, or whatever bullshit they want to come up with. They can't rationalize away money. You know, they brag about their money. You know, they brag about it, and they absolutely take any other tack other than money to attack other people with. And I completely agree. I think class, the only way really to really bite them is to maybe go into class warfare. I don't like the idea, but you know, they brought this on themselves.
Well, you know, look at what do you think the socioeconomic status of the average gamer is? I mean, you're not talking about class, people that are making a lot of money, and it really, it strikes me that sometimes that gaming in this day and age and culture where males are sometimes prevented from going out and actually adventuring. You know, gaming is a substitute for that, and it's a way for people who might have otherwise, you know, tedious lives with middle class jobs, to have something that's a little pulse pounding and interesting. You know, it's a surrogate for that.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, I doubt any of them have had a proper job. So I don't think any of them really suffered any kind of hardship. I mean, this is Melody Hensley, PTSD from Twitter. Oh, fuck off.
Melody Hensley is the luckiest person on earth because she was able to get, you know, the story of the Center for Inquiry, which was it was founded by a guy named Kurtz, and then somewhere in the process there was a coup where. Right. The control was wrested away from him, and Hensley was one of the people that was, you know, backing the person. So she got a cushy little job, didn't she?
Of course she did.
What other job could you possibly have where you... She's not showing up for work. She said she was bedridden for 3 months. Who the hell gets a 3-month sabbatical? I mean, isn't laying around in bed claiming that you got PTSD from Twitter? Isn't that the ultimate indulgence?
Jesus Christ. Just when you say it, it's just like, you know what? That's absurd. It's just laughable. I just... laying around in bed claiming you got PTSD from Twitter is one of the funniest things I think I've ever heard in my
Most
life.
Most people have to buck it up, get their ass out of bed, and go to work.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's the entitlement. I'm so fucking entitled to you giving a shit about how I feel. I'm going to make up the most ridiculous thing in the world, and you're still... I'm still going to expect you to take it seriously.
Right. I mean, there's no insight in that. I mean, she obviously has no idea of how she appears.
Yeah, no self-awareness. That's another social justice trait.
But, you know, narcissism comes into it because, you know, I've seen some, unfortunately, videos that, like, say, Rebecca Watson has done, and a lot of them are just her just off the top of her head. She did one video that was 3 minutes long. It was her changing a signal switch in her car, and she was getting paid money for that.
Jesus,
She actually, you know, figured this would be of interest to my subscribers.
I can hardly believe that people would think of that as interesting in any way. I mean, she did recently. In fact, I've been planning to do a video on this. Recently, she did a video about an anti-vaxxer woman who was sent threats by people in the anti-vaxxer community to play the victim social justice style, in classic Anita Sarkeesian style, in how that she says, you know, oh, she was threatened at a talk she was going to give in Australia or something, and she pulled out of it, and instead of just, you know, instead of taking a word for it was a woman doing it, so instead of taking a word for it like a good feminist, listening and believing, she instead, you know, went for the kill and was like, no, this was rubbish. Apparently, it turns out that it was some, or it might have been some some other anti-vaxxer doing it as a false flag or something, blah, blah, blah. And yet, she is. I've got a video clip of this is what I'm going to do a video on. I've got a video clip of her saying literally almost exactly the same thing about Anita Sarkeesian, except she doesn't exactly know where it's come from, the threats, theoretically, quote-unquote, threats have come from. And so she's completely, oh, well, definitely misogynist gamers. Anita is such a brave woman. You know, and it's just like, good God, you know, just it's exactly the same circumstance. It's just which, you know, Rebecca Watson likes games and she doesn't like anti-vaxxers. So guess which one she's on the side of.
Yeah, well, you know, you think eventually people would catch on to this little page out of the playbook. But they never do. People just line up and saying, oh, poor you. It works. It absolutely works.
You know, I think there is a so there is a certain sort of mass that this can get to. Because I'm just going to look something up quickly. I mean, if you look at Rebecca Watson's channel, she has had a very... She's only 18,000 subscribers, which I don't like to talk numbers, really, because to me, they're generally quite... I don't like talking about the numbers.
Yeah, whenever I know my subscribers to anything, it's accidentally...
I try to not look, and then people are like, oh, well done, you've hit this number, and I'm like, oh, thanks very much. But if you look at like her, she's on 18,000. She's been on 18,000 for months. You know, she grows very, very slowly, and I think it's because she's not really drawing people in. She's just got this echo chamber. She's got the people who she got in with the clique. And they're supporting her, so she will tell them what they want to hear. And it's just this little feedback.
Well, speaking of pissing it away, I mean, Rebecca Watson is a study in missed opportunities. She came out of the JREF forum, where she never really participated in the sections that actually dealt with skeptical topics. She dealt on the socializing sections of it,
of course, you know,
she where she could play girl on the internet.
Yeah.
And she actually achieved some prominence. She got identified as the skeptical chick. She had a gig on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, but they recently got rid of her. And, you know, her entire career has been looking for that Reichstag fire that she can point to get attention. Mm-hmm. And now she's just sort of dwindling away into nothing and... Because she doesn't do anything. I can't think of a single video she does or a piece of. She had a gig where she was getting paid for. I forget what mag. It might have been Scientific American, where she had like a guest column, and all she had to do was do a weekly column or a bi-weekly column, and it wasn't that long. And she missed her first couple of deadlines for doing it. I mean, she just couldn't rouse herself.
One column every 2 weeks.
Was it?
Well, then you just said, was it a bi-weekly was it twice a week, was that, sorry?
No, it was once or once every 2 weeks.
And she missed her first one.
Yeah, and she did, I mean, just, these people have been given every opportunity of prominence, and they can't do anything with it. I mean, Anita Sarkeesian, what has she done with it? Well, that's because she's fishing around for the next buck, but, you know... There's just nothing comes of it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the issue, isn't it? I mean, but the thing is, I think
because they're not actually creating anything. They're a form of parasitism.
Yeah, I agree. I think they are parasitical on people's goodwill. That's I think ultimately it. They completely take advantage of the fact that most people want to do good things, and so we're social justice. Oh, okay. Tell me about social justice. Helping women, helping minorities. Oh my God, I want to do that. How are you going to do that? Well, I'm going to do that by completely taking advantage of you and completely being an awful person. But I'm not going to tell you I'm being an awful person. I'm going to tell you lies after lies because I have a narrative, and it's just like, You couldn't make it up.
Well, they distract from the subject at hand, really. I mean, in the skeptical community, there's atheism, it may or may not be fun, but there's probably some benefit in pointing out that, you know, so much effort has been put into getting on God's good side and building cathedrals and things like that. It would be interesting what would have happened historically if it was actually, you know, something done with an actual purpose. I mean, if you think about it, great cathedrals were built on the backs of their surrounding communities.
Absolutely.
And it was a generational strain because it often took generations to build these things. So there's that. But in the skeptical community, one, it's fun. I mean, if you're interested in Bigfoot on either side of the debate, at least you can get out there in the fresh air and look at some bear shit, you know, and argue over whether or not it's Bigfoot. But these people have managed to just take away from the subject. I mean, the people in the skeptical community that do this, like supposedly Rebecca Watson, they don't actually do skepticism. They distract from the in fact, they deride actual inquiry into skeptical things like cryptozoology as Bigfoot skepticism. And my question would be, well, what else are you doing?
I think that your point about how they managed to take the skepticism out of the skeptical community is—it's incredible, actually, isn't it? How else could that have been done? You know, what other methods could they have? What other groups could possibly have gone into a community dedicated to skepticism and sucked the skepticism out?
Yeah, you know,
that is.
I mean, the subject of skepticism is fascinating enough. I mean, one of the things that always attracted me was the minutia of it, and like if you study something like the Patterson-Gimlin film, it's the famous film of Bigfoot striding across.
I have seen that. Yes,
and it was originally very jerky, but someone image stabilizing it.
Yep.
There is a lifetime of research you can do on that, with photogrammetry of figuring out how it was shot, who shot it, what their motivation was, whether it was a fat guy in a suit.
I reckon it was a fat guy in a suit.
Or, with the Bermuda Triangle, you learn that really the modern myth of the Bermuda Triangle was the result of, like, three guys incestuously feeding off each other. Vincent Gaddis, Charles Berlitz of Berlitz language fame, and like the writers of Argosy magazine, and it got, every time they copied off each other, got better in the retelling. But you can actually go back to original source documents, meteorology, and learn that when they say this ship disappeared in clear skies and it was a beautiful day, it was actually a storm, and the ship was carrying, like, 20,000 tons of coal, something like that.
Yeah, so,
you know,
suddenly an explanation comes to light. Just,
well, one of the most fascinating things which arose out of von Daniken sort of stuff was there was once a claim that the Aztec masonry was so precisely fit together that you couldn't slip a piece of paper between it.
Oh, that claim's been made about the Egyptian pyramids. Pretty much any pyramid.
But the explanation that they came up with was fascinating. What they did was they roughly fit the stones, and they had two people on either side working them back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Until they ground the stones into each other. And it would never occur to us because that was a shitload of work. You know, the point is, there's so many fascinating aspects of this that these people coming in and saying, well, skepticism is all very nice, but I think it's more interesting that we talk about misogyny.
The one place I used to hang out in a lot of history message boards and stuff like that, and you did get this sort of ancient astronaut phenomenon where you would get someone who comes in and says, oh my god, the Egyptian pyramids were built by aliens, look how perfect they are. And then you'd have to point out to them, look, right, like, if you look at the, like, 500 years preceding that, there are a bunch of other Egyptian pyramids leading up to it that are shit. There's like the leaning pyramid. There's the
one collapsed.
Yeah, exactly. And they're bulging in weird places because they were learning the craft, you know. And then when they'd learned the craft, they decided to build a fucking giant one. Obviously, the pharaoh had a lot of resources, but it wasn't magical. And they had professional teams, and there was no Exodus. There were no Hebrews in Egypt, as far as anyone can tell.
No, you know, there were war crews that competed against them.
Exactly, they were professionals. You know, no wonder they built such magnificent pyramids. Do you think such great monuments would be built by slaves? You get what you pay for.
Yeah, you know, the world as it is fascinating enough. I mean, that was always my criticism of when people would reach for supernatural explanations. I said, you know, you have to eliminate the natural explanations first, and the natural explanations are in and of themselves enough. They're fascinating.
Yeah. And so, one thing, like you said, people underestimate how much work people in the past were prepared to put in. Because they look at that themselves and think, God, that's a lot of work. I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a learning experience in actually carrying out skepticism. I mean, to learn how people can be can lie to themselves and lie to other people or just get things wrong. Mm. And, you know, the idea of social justice warriors piggybacking on this is just ludicrous.
Yep, it absolutely is. Right, okay, it's kind of 12:30 here, so I think I'm probably going to have to call it a night, which is a shame because I've really, really enjoyed
Fair
the conversation.
Enough.
And I really appreciate you coming on. I think a lot of people have been waiting for me to have you on, given the 1,400 people watching. So honestly, thank you so much. And at some point in the future, if you don't mind, I'll... Sorry?
1,416. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe if we keep going, we'll get... Oh, no, we don't work on that, how many hits we get.
No, we don't.
No, I think it's...
We're not going to strengthen our arguments.
I would make... You had... the one time, didn't you have Thunderfoot and Justicar on?
No, that was Internet Aristocrats.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
But I would definitely like to have those on.
I think we should get a round table going.
I would love to do that. I absolutely would.
Yeah, that would be interesting if we could get something, you know, do it more or less regular and, you know, in response to some of this, to practice what we were talking about, which is getting the word out via YouTube.
I think that's a really good idea. But just to keep growing the people on the rational side of this argument, you know, the people who care about facts and reason.
We have to network, and I think one of the great things that is happening here with you and me and Internet Aristocrat is sort of networking together the atheist and skeptical community with the gaming community. Since we had the influx of social justice warriors first, we can kind of give you a heads up.
Absolutely, that's one of the reasons that Internet Aristocrat got Justicar and Thunderfoot on his channel, and that's why I've got you on now. Just seriously, they've been here and done this before, and they will go to other places and try it in other locations. So as much in, you know, just I think networking is the best way to describe it because we really just need to talk to people who are going to experience social justice warriors.
Great, it's decided. Let's do more of that. And really piss them off.
Absolutely, fuck these guys. Seriously, they're fucking awful people. Awful people, and they deserve everything they bloody get.
That's the right note to end on. They're fucking horrible, awful people. There's no excuse for them. They're bad people, they do bad things, and they should feel bad about themselves.
They fucking should. Thanks very much, man. And thanks for everyone for listening.
Thanks for having me. And good night, everyone.
My pleasure. Cheers.